It's time for the Scott Rintoul Show.
He holds, he shoots, he scores!
Where the West...
Pettersson off the left wing, steps into a slap shot and scores. Elias Pettersson, oh my word, again.
Is one.
Rebound, Kachuk scores! What a night for Matthew Kachuk.
Let's make it happen. Everything you've got, no excuses.
Jackson avoids, spins, he's in. Touchdown, McCaffrey leaps.
Now, here's Scott Rintoul.
Pull my trigger, let me blow your mind.
What's going on? How's your Thursday going so far? Scott Rintoul with you. We'll get you through the next couple of hours. We will entertain you, hopefully educate you a little along the way as well. And we do want your contributions to the program today. Hit me up. You've got the text message numbers. You can find me on Twitter, at Scott Rintoul. We do this on Thursdays. We do Take the L, and we do it in the first segment, and we sprinkle some in throughout the course of the program. But we would like you to tell us who should take the L this week. We'll give you a couple of our thoughts later this segment, but we want you in on this conversation. Who should take the L? Who needs to just step back, stop fighting about it, or you see something that happened in sports? Buddy, you need to just take the L. Stand down. Where are you at? Send us those contributions. Hit us up in the text message inbox. We'd like to get you involved in the show. Calgary Flames took the L last night, and it's amazing to me how often this seems to happen in pro sports, and recently it's happened in hockey a couple of times. You miss a golden opportunity, and all of a sudden it bites you right away. Right away. In fact, I'm almost surprised it didn't bite the Seahawks on Monday night. I guess it did. K.J. Wright could have ended that game with an interception at the end. And the 49ers forced overtime as a result. Now, the Seahawks got over, but it just seems like when you have a golden opportunity, something that seems so easy, so gift-wrapped for you, and you blow it, it stings you right away. And that happened last night in Calgary. Michael Backlund should have been on the business end of a 3-on-1 goal, empty net, and he pushes it back across the crease. In a 1-0 hockey game at the time, third period, and the Flames don't score. They don't tie it up at that point in time. What happens? Puck goes back up ice, and wouldn't you know it, the Dallas Stars capitalize. It's 2-0 at that point. Flames never able to come back. They got one closer, but were never able to get back on even terms. And all of a sudden, that turns out to be the game-winning goal. It happened to the Canucks last week in Winnipeg. Bo Horvat has Connor Hellebuck swimming on the ice, trying to stuff the puck in. Hellebuck reaches back, and Horvat can't quite close. What happens the next sequence? Kyle Connor strips the puck, goes the other way, and that's all she wrote for the Vancouver Canucks. Seems like that happens every so often in pro sports. It seems like it's happened recently in hockey as well. But the guy on the business end of that game-winning goal is such a great story. And it was easy to feel good about at least that aspect, if you're a Flames fan, of the guy who scored the game-winning goal. Justin Dowling. He's a Calgary native. He's undrafted. He was undrafted as a bantam, made his way into the dub, undrafted, and goes and plays in the ECHL as a professional. He graduates to the A. He has played well over 400 games in the American Hockey League. Last night, just his 34th game in the show. And in his hometown, a guy who has fought and scrapped and clawed his way just to get to the NHL, just to get NHL games, he scores his first NHL goal. His family's in attendance. His mom is in attendance. What a great moment. And she gets interviewed during the broadcast about her son's first goal.
Welcome back to the Saddle Dome. Welcome in Sherry Dowling, mom to Justin Dowling, here to witness his first ever NHL goal from Cochrane. Great to have the friends and family here, Sherry. Feel bad you missed the goal. Why?
I was dealing with a drink.
Priority.
I was dealing with a drink. I love it. I love it. And you know why I love it? Because she was honest about it. She could have said to Ryan Leslie on that broadcast, no, I saw it. Great goal. I'm so excited. And told him, let's just go with that. But she was honest about it. And it's something we can all relate to. We've all gone out during the course of a game to grab a beer and you miss something big. Are you kidding me? I was sitting there waiting for my beer, or I had to use the facilities here, and that happened while I was doing. Are you kidding me? If you've got a story like that, if you were at a game, if you were in the beer line, if you took a little longer to get back to your seat, if you had to use the facilities and you missed the big goal or a big moment or something you should have been there for and you weren't quite back to your seat in the rink or at another sporting event, send it to me. Hit me up. I loved that moment last night because I think we can all relate to that. I think we've all been somewhere similar. I kind of screwed that up. Nothing worse than leaving the game early and something big happens. The massive comeback. I'm going to be traffic. I'm getting out of here. These guys have no chance of coming back. And you leave and something magical happens. And you should have been there, but you weren't. But this one, a little more understandable, relatable. And I loved his comment after the game as well. He was magic about it. He didn't know his mom had not been in her seat watching his first ever goal in his 34th NHL game. And so Ryan Leslie interviews him after the game. He says, that sounds like the Dowlings. Yeah, that's us. We got to make sure that we have a good time at the game. And then he said, no, it's great. I'm glad she was going to grab a drink and she was having a great time at this game. Apparently he celebrated afterwards. Again, maybe that's not any solace to Flames fans as this team just can't quite get itself on track. You know, it's funny with Calgary and Brendan Morrison, hopefully will talk to us about this in the bottom of the second hour. If you know anything about Brendan, you know that he's an outdoorsman and he's on an outdoor excursion this morning. So when we talked yesterday, he said, I'm hoping I have cell service. I want in on the show. I said, why don't you just take the day off? No, I want in on the show. I just have to make sure I have cell service. So we're hoping to have Brendan Morrison on talking about this. I do want to talk to him about the fits and starts nature of the Calgary Flames to start this season. Here's the good news. They haven't lost more than two games in a row. Here's the bad news. They haven't won more than two games in a row. It's been win one, lose one, win a couple, lose a couple. Just can't seem to get rolling. The good news? They haven't played themselves out of it. They're still within arm's reach. They're still hanging right in around a playoff spot right now. It's not as though they've gone San Jose to start this season. The bad news? Other teams are picking up points, and there are games that are hanging in the balance they just can't seem to close on right now. And I thought the guys in the morning on Sportsnet 960 did a great job talking about this. I'm not sure what it is, but it is missing right now for the Calgary Flames. It's not there often enough. That intangible factor, that feeling you have about a team that it can get itself headed in the right direction, or even when they play a bad game and lose, a couple of wins or three more wins are just around the corner. And right now, that seems to be missing. We'll talk to Brendan Morrison about that, hopefully, at the bottom of the second hour. Something else happened last night in Calgary that was worth noting, and it's the first game on the other side of it tonight for Corey Perry. Last night, Corey Perry became the 340th player in National Hockey League history to play 1,000 games, which is pretty impressive when you remember Corey Perry getting drafted and everybody said he can't skate. Not going to be good enough. This is a guy that will not be able to skate in the NHL. It's why he dropped toward the bottom of the first round in his draft class. Now, his draft class is one of the most remarkable in NHL history. You can argue it's the best draft class we've ever seen, and I would stand by that argument right now. The 2003 draft class is insanely good. If you know anything about draft classes, you know what I'm talking about here. He plays 1,000 games. On Saturday, another member of his draft class, Jeff Carter, is slated to play his 1,000th game. You start looking down that draft. There are already 11 players from the 03 draft that have played 1,000 games. When Carter does it on Saturday, that is going to be 12. Realistically, when you look at the list of guys who are still in the league, there are another five guys that should hit that. So that's 17 guys in one draft class that are likely going to play 1,000 games in the league. And that's on the low end. So the floor is probably 17. The ceiling is probably 20. 20 players from the same draft class playing 1,000 games. Yeah, it speaks to the better shape the guys keep themselves in. All of those things. But you just don't normally hit it like that. In fact, you go back and look at the couple of draft classes before that, 2002, 2001, that sort of thing. That's like 7, 5. 1,000 games is a lot. Tough to do. And there are already 11, going to be 12 on Saturday, 1,000-game players in that draft. And you start to go back to that draft, and you start to look at it, and one of the things that jumps out, most drafts are filled with first-round regret. Fans know this. Doesn't matter which team you're a fan of. Even if your team has a good drafting record, you've got a couple of draft classes where you go, man, we drafted this guy, but we should have taken blank. And I'm not talking about the guy who goes in round number 7 or round number 5. that turns into this 1,000-game player. And, boy, I don't know how everybody missed on him, because that guy wasn't graded as a first or top of the second-round talent. I'm talking about guys who were in the same conversation, and some fans said, we want that guy. Okay, we can live with this guy at the time. And then it turns out that the guy you wanted or you could have taken, he goes on to this great career, and you have this draft regret. There's a little bit of that in the 03 class, but in most cases of that draft, it is an easier pill to swallow. I will give you an example. San Jose that year. Again, this incredible draft class where up to 20 guys are going to play 1,000 games. San Jose that year, sixth overall, Milan Mihalik. Now, Ryan Suter goes with the next pick. Would you rather have Ryan Suter? Yes, of course you would. But it's a little easier to stomach when the guy you picked sixth overall plays almost 750 games in the league, scores almost 450 points and over 200 goals. Okay, we didn't get the best guy there. We still drafted a very good player. There's one team that stands out as a sore thumb. One, it's the Rangers. That draft, when it was hard to mess up in the first round of the 03 draft, there were that many good players. The Rangers at number 12, Hugh Jessamyn. I know. I don't know who he is either. Two games. The next two picks that followed, Dustin Brown, who captained two Stanley Cup winning teams, and Brent Seabrook. He worked out okay as well. I know his contract's not working out right now, but he did just fine. Parise, Getzlaff, Kessler, Richards, Perry, they all go after that pick as well. So yes, the Rangers are that team that sticks out in that draft because it was so hard to mess it up. And somehow the Rangers did. But what a draft class it is. As mentioned, Corey Perry doing his tour of Western Canada now. He sort of ties in with the next guy I'm about to bring up, Wendell Clark. Wendell Clark was that guy who was doing the rounds today. He was on a variety of Sportsnet stations. Weiser's has him in. They do this every year. They come up with a couple of new concoctions, and they get some former greats and some excellent conversations with Wendell Clark on the airways in Vancouver and Toronto and Calgary today. And everybody kept noting the same thing, because what happens when you have a PR firm send you the information about the player and what they'd like you to promote with the player, they give you the bio, just in case you didn't know. You might not know. Maybe you don't know everything about Wendell Clark. Oh, yeah, I remember him as great Leaf, really good player. Kind of remember him as a Nordique a little bit. Oh, yeah, he played for the Chicago Blackhawks. And I noted that in Calgary, they were having a little fun with that. In Vancouver, they were saying the exact same thing. Oh, yeah, Wendell Clark. I don't imagine there's a lot of Chicago Blackhawks jerseys. And so I've seen a lot of listeners throughout the course of the morning saying, you remember this guy? He went on to play there. A guy in Vancouver, for example, is Matt Sundin. Oh, yeah. Matt Sundin played half a season for the Canucks, even though you remember him as a Leaf primarily and a Quebec Nordique shortly thereafter. And so that's been suggested all morning. Guys like Franco Harris. You remember Franco Harris makes the immaculate reception? He was a Seahawk at one point. The end of his career. Nobody remembers it, but he went on and played there. Emmitt Smith broke the rushing record with the Arizona Cardinals instead of with the Dallas Cowboys. But we all know what Emmitt Smith is. We all know what Wendell Clark is. He's a Toronto Maple Leaf. That's just the feel for him. With all due respect to Ray Bourque's banner hanging in Colorado, he is a Boston Bruin. The tail end of his career, that one's a little different. You're never going to forget he was an Avalanche because that's where he eventually got his cup. But you get what I'm saying. And it's fun to start throwing out those names of, oh, did you remember this guy played there? Yeah, throw those out. And if you want to send me those, we can have a little fun with that throughout the course of the morning. It did get me thinking about this, however. For all of those people who continue to go down that road of, oh, don't sign that. Don't sign a one-year deal there. Don't do that. Don't tarnish your legacy. That's such a crock. It's such a crock. Michael Jordan goes and plays for the Wizards. People have a big problem with Michael Jordan playing for the Wizards? Or do you just remember him as a Bull and as the greatest player of all time? And in that argument, nobody remembers. Okay, he went and did it. Yeah, he came back, took a few bucks. You blame the guy? Not really. I don't blame Emmitt Smith for going and playing for the Cardinals. I don't blame Matt Sundin for saying, okay, Mike Gillis in this case, you've been calling a lot and you've been offering $10 million a year. I guess I'll take it. That sounds like pretty good money. Yeah, okay, I can do that. No, because he's remembered for everything he did in Toronto, and he'll always go down as a Maple Leaf. So I don't blame these guys whatsoever, and I've never bought the he's going to tarnish his legacy. No, the legacy is what fans remember. Did Wayne Gretzky tarnish his legacy by coaching the Arizona Coyotes? No, he didn't. I remember that argument being made at the time. Ah, Wayne Gretzky. I mean, he's a terrible coach. Wonder how people are going to remember this. They're still going to remember him as the greatest player of all time. That's my answer there. I don't think there's a lot of debate. Well, I don't know. Might have to put Lemieux ahead of him because Gretzky didn't coach the Coyotes real well. No, that's not how you remember it. That argument was had in Vancouver with Trevor Linden as well. You might not fondly remember Trevor Linden as an executive with the Vancouver Canucks. You may have beefs with some of the moves he made or didn't make at the time. Doesn't mean he's not going to be remembered as an all-time great Canuck, one of the greatest ever. You want in on that conversation, get in as well. But it's that time. Every Thursday we do it. We want you in on this. Take an L. Take an L. Who needs to take an L today? Hit it, Raja.
But sometimes you got to take a loss and have people rub it in your face before you get made pissed off.
All right, that's Raja Shergirl, I should say. He's back at Mission Control. He is producing the show today, and Raja's going to weigh in on this in just a second. I will get this kicked off, and I see some of the contributions coming in. Continue to send them my way. The NFL needs to take a loss. I would have nominated it anyway, but it's made even easier for me over the course of the last 24 hours. The NFL needs to take another L, in addition to the one it has in its name, for this sham of a showcase involving Colin Kaepernick. I asked yesterday, why now? Why are you doing this? Why did he have to come in on such short notice? Why are you doing it on a Saturday when teams are traveling, when scouts are at college games, when executives are flying around the country trying to figure out what they're going to do with their draft plans right now? Why would you do it then? And it's been exposed already. Already this has been exposed. People have been digging around this, and they have found out that Kaepernick's agents and he were handed this take it or leave it, and it's happening on short notice, and you better be there. And we find out that other teams were calling the NFL. Why would they call the NFL? Oh, I don't know. If you just want to work a guy out, you can bring him in. Oh, I guess the NFL might have a little policy in place that prevents you from bringing in Colin Kaepernick. But now it comes out that the NFL isn't even going to give Kaepernick and his representatives a list of the people who will be in attendance. They were going to make that public. That's what came out yesterday. The NFL is holding this showcase for Colin Kaepernick. They're going to let him work out for everybody. You can see where he's at, and hopefully you can bring him in. That was the big pitch yesterday. And we're going to tell you who's going to be there. All eyes on Atlanta. All 32 teams we're hoping will be represented. Now, actually, we're not going to tell Cap who's going to be there because there's probably some teams that can't make it. And the reporters who've been in conversation with sources on teams say they're confused by this entire operation as well. What a sham. Take an L, NFL. Take an L. That's where I'll get it started. Raja, you've got one. You've got somebody you think needs to take an L this morning.
Yeah, I do. I've got a team that I think should take an L, and it's the New York Islanders. Despite winning yesterday, they were grilling John Tavares again, telling him that we don't need you. Yes, I think we all know that how well the Islanders are playing, that they don't need John Tavares. So it's time to move on. Take an L. Stop and just let this man live. Every time he comes to Brooklyn, Long Island, he does not need to hear it from New York Islanders fans, especially considering the fact that this team is on a 13-game point streak, Scotty. This team, the fans of this team, I should say, just need to relax and be happy.
See, I'm going to disagree with you this morning, Raja. I understand what you're saying, but I don't think we're there yet. I think this is still too raw. I think this is still you got left at the altar. We're less than 2 years later. I'm sorry, I can't have you at my party. I may have moved on. I may have a new bride. I may have somebody that I really like, but I can't have you here yet. And that's what it is with Tavares. I liked it last night, even though I'm of the opinion that I would just go to the game and support my team. I got to admit, as a fan, I found it pretty fun last night to tune in to hear Islanders fans chanting, "We don't need you."
Well, here's the other side of that,
but
though.
But they kind of do, though, Raja. They kind of need him. They still love him.
They do love him there. The other side of this is, though, John Tavares scores yesterday, and that's a game that the Islanders won 5-4. But if that's a different scoring game and Tavares scores against the Islanders, they're going to be shut up pretty quickly.
Yeah, he did score at the end.
And Tavares
and there
could
was
be
that
handing
moment.
Islanders fans L's if he continues to light the lamp over there.
I guarantee there were a lot of people who got quiet in a hurry because the Islanders were up 5-2, and then there's two late goals. The goal by Jared Hull, and then John Tavares scores with less than 30 seconds left. And I guarantee you there were a lot of people that went, uh-oh, what did we do? Did we awaken the dragon? Yeah. It made for good theater, and that's kind of the reason I still like it. You're giving the L to them. I'm disagreeing with you a little bit, but that's what we want from you. We want submissions. Who needs to take an L? This one comes in. Nav from Surrey, and it's a good one. I agree with this wholeheartedly. Take an L. All the NFL scouts and NFL GMs who said Lamar Jackson should convert to wide receiver. Lamar Jackson right now, in most people's estimation, is second in the MVP running. Maybe third. Russell Wilson is still head of the class. Lamar Jackson continues to close the gap, but he's in his first full year as a starter in the league. First full year. And he might be the MVP of the NFL. And you're right, Raja, or pardon me, Nav in Surrey. That's who suggested this one. Less than two years ago, people were telling this guy, you're never going to make it as a quarterback. You want to play in this league? Tell you what you need to do. You need to convert to wide receiver. Good for him for sticking by his guns. Good for the Ravens who moved up in that draft to get him and said, actually, we think this could work. Good for the Ravens for also halfway through last season seeing that he is the future. Joe Flacco is a dinosaur with the way the game is going. They moved on in the middle of last season, and then they doubled down. The Ravens went out and they got Greg Roman as their offensive coordinator and let him run the show. They tailored this to Lamar Jackson. It wasn't, well, I'm not sure if you can be an NFL quarterback. Let's see if you can fit into our system. No, we're going to change the system. Tanbeer says the 49ers took the biggest L this week. Disagree. Disagree completely. Technically, yes, they lost a game. Is there a great shame in losing to Russell Wilson on Monday night in overtime? Is there great shame in that? Is that a big L? I don't think so. They're still 8-1. Now, if this plummets out of control, maybe we're talking about it as the start of a downward spiral. I don't think the 49ers took the biggest L this week. I'm a little biased. I'll admit that. I'm a little biased, but I don't think they took the biggest L this week. Good segue, though, because coming up next, we are going to start talking a little NFL football. Week 11 kicks off tonight. It's Steelers at Browns. Who would have thought the Steelers, with no Ben Roethlisberger, would roll into this game as a team with designs on an AFC wildcard spot, and the Browns, with all the offseason hype, would be just trying to save face at this point of the season. Dieter Kurtenbach will join me next, right here on the Scott Rentoul Show, and I will ask him, among other questions, what is the biggest thing, the biggest concern in San Francisco after what happened on Monday against Russell Wilson and the Seahawks? That's next on the Scott Rentoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rentoul Show. Baby, be
my fire. Couple more submissions pouring in for Take the L. It's Scott Rentoul. This is the Scott Rentoul Show, and we're going to talk a little NFL football here in just a couple of minutes' time. Dieter Kurtenbach, Bay Area News Group, is going to join me. An unforgettable Monday nighter in San Francisco. He was all over it. There are questions about what this means for the 49ers, probably ones that aren't going to get answered this week as they take on the Arizona Cardinals. Maybe not the doormats people thought they'd be at the start of the season. Maybe a tougher out than you would have suspected, but some business the Niners should take care of at home. They should move to 9-1. It's never a given, but they should move to 9-1, and then it gets difficult. Then it's Lamar Jackson and Aaron Rodgers and Drew Brees. The next three games are against those three teams. That's when it gets difficult for the San Francisco 49ers. A couple more submissions pouring in. The refs from Monday Night Football should take a huge L. That's Riley from Port Moody. And you could actually argue that from both sides. I think the Seahawks were on the short end of the stick for most of it. I thought the Seahawks were undone a few times by the referees. Calls that didn't need to be made. And then in other cases, weren't made when similar infractions happened on the San Francisco 49ers. But you can also argue they screwed it up in overtime. You watch that replay again where Mostert's trying to get a first down before the 49ers missed their field goal attempt. He got a first down. They incorrectly spotted that ball, and they went to replay, and they screwed it up twice. Pretty surprising, actually. But I understand the point, Riley from Port Moody. Yeah, the refs really this season. I think it's more the command center and Al Riveron and the officiating cartel, as I call it, in the NFL. I think those guys deserve more of an L because they just continue to back officials on poor calls. I get having your guys back. I get, hey, the call on the field stands unless we have overwhelming evidence. But there have been numerous cases of overwhelming evidence in the NFL this year where they've said, just go with the call. Just go with our guys. And as a viewer, now you've lost me credibility-wise. I don't know what you're going to call anymore. And the second that happens, you've got a bit of a problem. Another late one rolled in. Given the news of Andrew Ladd, who's been waived by the New York Islanders. Now, that's not going to mean anything. No one's going to take that money on. But he's been waived. We'll see exactly what they decide to do with Andrew Ladd in New York. And so maybe the Islanders need to take an L on that signing. I would actually extend that to the numerous GMs who signed awful contracts in the summer of 2016. I think most fans have already made peace with these. They don't like them, but I think they've made peace with them. But that summer, it's remarkable. Lucic, as in Milan Lucic, gets 7 years, $42 million. Kyle Okpozo, 7 years, $42 million. Andrew Ladd, who I just mentioned, 7 years, $38.5 million. Louis Eriksson, 6 years, $36 million. Franz Nielsen, 6 years, $31.5 million. David Backes, 5 years, $30 million. Darren Helm, 5 years, over 19 schmil. Troy Brower, 4 years, $18 million. Not great contracts. James Reimer was the other one, 5 years, $17 million, that were on a list that Dmitry Filipovich tweeted out. Not a great summer of GMing when it came to the free agency market. And one that probably sticks in the back of the mind of every single one of those guys who signed those contracts. Yeah, going to have to take an L on that one. Not going to do that again. It's probably changed the way each approaches free agency since that time. I know Jim Benning, who signed one of those contracts, was under heat for the Jay Beagle deal and the Antoine Roussel deal at the time, which people in Vancouver are actually a lot cooler with right now after what he did in his first year in Vancouver. But the term was always the question. But when you're making what you consider a $3 million mistake as opposed to a $6 or $7 million mistake, and the term is way down, 4 years compared to 7 years, I think we're talking apples and oranges. You don't have to like those contracts. You don't have to like paying guys in your bottom six the kind of money we're talking about. But they're not the albatross contracts that Andrew Ladd and Louis Eriksson and Milan Lucic have become. Those aren't them whatsoever. Continue to send in your contributions and your submissions. We'll get them on the air as we continue throughout the program. But now we turn our attention back to the National Football League. As promised, Dieter Kurtenbach of the Bay Area News Group joins me now to talk a little football. Dieter, thank you very much for doing this. How are you? Do we have Dieter there, Raja? Can't hear him on the air. So we're going to see if we can get Dieter on the air here. All right, we'll get Dieter punched up here in just 1 second. As mentioned, we're going to talk a little football with Dieter. He was all over the game between the 49ers and the Seahawks on Monday. I want to know what the most legitimate concern is down in the Bay Area right now, because I think there were people making too much out of one guy. I want to see if Dieter Kurtenbach agrees with that when we can get him on the air here. I also want to know who he thinks the team to beat is in the NFC West. Did it change your view completely? Going in, you had to go with the 49ers, unless you were just such a diehard Seahawks fan that you said, nope, Russell Wilson, that's going to be the team to beat. Niners were unblemished. One of the best defenses in the league. How did your view of the NFC West change as a result of what happened on Monday? Or maybe it didn't. See if we can get Dieter on here. Dieter Kurtenbach, the Bay Area News Group, joining me now. Dieter, let's try this again. How are you?
I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well, and I'm glad that technology has allowed us to connect here. Let's talk about what happened Monday night. Unforgettable game at Levi's Stadium. 49ers on the losing end of arguably the game of the season to date. What is the most legitimate concern coming out of that loss to Seattle?
Injuries. And that was the biggest concern going into the game, probably. They did not get any healthier coming out of an NFL game. Wild thought. They're pretty banged up. George Kittle doesn't look like he's going to play on Sunday. We saw what that did for the 49ers offense. They just really couldn't move the ball once Seattle keyed in on the run game. Without Kittle, there is a safety blanket for Garoppolo. Now they're down Emmanuel Sanders. He's day-to-day with a rib injury that he left with in that Seattle game. he's also the safety. They really don't have any receivers other than Kittle and Sanders. So, yeah, pretty big concern that both of those guys are injured. And I think the defense took a noticeable step back without Quan Alexander. He's not a household name or anything, but he was their weak side linebacker, and I thought he really held together both the run and the pass defense. I thought that they had to make some concessions schematically for what they did on the defensive end without Quan Alexander, and I think Seattle found some advantages on the offensive end by just attacking that.
The low-hanging fruit to me coming out of that game was, Jimmy Garoppolo can't get it done. Do you agree with that?
Ooh, no, I disagree with that, mainly because I saw what happened on Halloween, and I understand that the Seattle Seahawks and the Arizona Cardinals are two different beasts, but defensively they're not. So saying that Jimmy Garoppolo didn't get it done, yeah, he didn't get it done in that game, but I would argue that it was a team effort in a loss. You have a kicker missing a 47-yard field goal. Yes, long field goal, don't get me wrong, but he had just made one moments earlier. He misses one about 45 yards to the left in overtime. If he makes that field goal, we have a very different conversation. People look at the three and out that the Niners had with about a minute 50 left in overtime. Okay, well, the first pass is batted down. The second pass goes right off of his receiver's hands. And the third pass, I thought, was kind of on the money, but you had an incredible defensive play, but it only took like 20-something seconds, and that's a three and out. They punt it away, and Seattle gets the ball with plenty of time to set up a win. A couple of his interceptions I thought were unfair. Then again, he threw a couple of balls that really should have been intercepted. Jimmy Garoppolo is not a great quarterback. Like, I think that we know this by now. At the same time, he has three more starts than Lamar Jackson and three fewer starts than Baker Mayfield. So maybe we shouldn't be totally ready to write him off in the bigger picture. He's up and down. He's kind of a new Tony Romo. But the thing with Tony Romo was he was good enough to win a Super Bowl. He just never had a defense like this, and he sure as hell never had a head coach like this. So Garoppolo, yeah, he didn't have the best game. He didn't cover himself in glory, but I wouldn't totally write this dude off, and more so than that, I wouldn't write off the 49ers at all. I think they have more than enough talent to overcome not having a transcendent quarterback, because I don't think not being Russell Wilson for a night is a sin.
Dieter Kurtenbach of the Bay Area News Group talking NFL right here on the Scott Rintoul Show. So coming out of that game, the team to beat in the NFC West is?
Seattle. It's still Seattle, because you got to beat the boogeyman if you're the 49ers, and they're going to play in Week 17 in Seattle. And that game just looks huge right now. The 49ers really missed an opportunity. We talk about narrative all the time because that's our life, that's our job. But narrative does, I think, matter a little bit in the NFL. The 49ers haven't beaten a great team yet. I think that the Rams have taken a clear step down, and so the rest of the teams that the 49ers have played on their schedule just don't ultimately impress. They don't say, hey, this is a Niners team that is good enough to go and win a Super Bowl. And I don't know if Seattle really qualified, but I'll say this. If they're not a great team, they certainly have a great player, Russell Wilson. And given the history that the 49ers had, given the stage that the 49ers had on Monday night, beating Russell Wilson on Monday Night Football at home would have been, I think, a leap forward for that team. And it would have put them at 9-0, which is laughable, just how good that would have been. And I think that coming into what I think the NFL says is the second hardest schedule over the last seven games, they would have had a lot of pressure off their shoulders. They wouldn't have had to beat the Saints or the Packers or the Ravens to prove that they're the real deal. But now they still are kind of in prove-it mode, because they couldn't beat Russell Wilson. Russell Wilson is now, I think, 13-3 all time against the 49ers. And Garoppolo still has to prove it. Now they're injured. And now they're in an NFC West race. They could have locked up the NFC West. They could have shown everybody that they're the number one team in the NFC, maybe the number one team in the NFL with a win. And now they're just kind of part of the middle, which is probably where they should have been. But again, narrative really does change everything going into a game. I think this Arizona game that they have on Sunday is going to be really tough. And listen, Seattle's got the NFL's MVP, in my opinion, and the 49ers, to be the man, you got to beat the man, in the words of Ric Flair, and to this moment, they have not beaten the man. So I think that Seattle still holds the crown, even though I think the Niners are generally a better team.
it's funny because it's a circular logic conversation when it comes to Seattle and San Francisco, isn't it? Because if people were going to say, well, that's proof the 49ers aren't a great team, they didn't beat Seattle, then Seattle didn't beat a great team either. And you look at their schedule and you can make the exact same argument. Well, when they played Baltimore, they lost. When they played New Orleans, they lost. I guess they haven't beat a great team. So we're having the same conversation, but these two teams simply have strengths in different areas. And the Seahawks, as you correctly pointed out, their greatest strength happens to be the most important position in sports.
Yeah, that really is the difference. And let's be real about what Wilson was on Monday night. He wasn't great, but he made the plays when he got the opportunity. Garoppolo didn't. He gave the ball to Wilson, and Wilson got it done. So if Dre Greenlaw, who intercepts Wilson at the 10-yard line in overtime, just gets one more block, we have a very different conversation. If a field goal happens, we have a very different conversation. I mean, you could point to 100 different moments in that game where we have a different conversation because Russell Wilson wasn't totally incredible, a number one, greatest quarterback performance you've ever seen. But he just gets the job done in the clutch every single time. So yeah, you're right. I don't think the Seahawks are a great team. I think, in fact, they're an incredibly flawed team. I do like some of their pieces, but boy, there are a lot of weaknesses there. But when you have a guy who just, he's magic. He's Houdini. He's the best there is in the NFL. He's one of the all-time greats. And I've been a huge fan of his for years just because, I don't know, he has the magic touch. And football is such a rudimentary game, you know, very X's and O's and schematic and all this stuff. And he just has this ineffable quality about him that makes it so much fun to watch him. He's the one guy in the NFL that I would really say you got to go and pay to see. So until the 49ers prove they can beat him, I gotta just presume that Russell Wilson's going to pull a rabbit out of a hat every single time. And listen, it will be one hell of a game to watch in week 17. I'll tell you that right now, even if maybe nothing's really on the line, but, I think it all squares up. I think that the playoffs start in the regular season for both of these teams.
Well, and the great thing is, as football fans, we hopefully have been given a gift of this rivalry reigniting, even if they aren't the best teams in the NFC right now, because we know just how torrid that rivalry was 5, 6, 7 years ago. It was fantastic. It was as good as any in the NFL. So if the Seahawks and the 49ers aren't the standard in the NFC, by default we're left talking about a Saints team that just got beat by Atlanta and a Packers team that got beat 2 weeks ago by the Chargers. Is there a clear number one team in the NFC?
No, not even close. In fact, I can make the argument that the Seahawks, because of Russell Wilson, are at this juncture because there isn't one. Listen, Drew Brees is an all-time great as well and one of the best to ever do it and all this stuff, but he can't throw the ball more than 20 yards down the field anymore. And defenses are finally figuring it out, and it's starting to look like a liability for the Saints if you can take away Michael Thomas, who I think is on pace for like 150-something catches. I mean, that's ridiculous. So I don't really buy the Saints, to be totally honest. And with the Packers, there's a weakness there. There's a weakness in that, you know, they're probably a little bit over-reliant on the run game, and the defense isn't as good as maybe we built them up to be early in the season. The NFC is wide open. The thing is, there's just like 10 teams inside a wide-open NFC. So I don't know who the hell is going to make the playoffs out of all of it. I think that the one team we can say with certainty is going to make the playoffs is the Niners, just because they already have 8 wins. Maybe the Seahawks count too because they have 8 wins as well. But yeah, it is going to be a blast. And I think some team with 9 wins is probably going to miss the playoffs out there.
In conversation with Dieter Kurtenbach of the Bay Area News Group, over the AFC, surprise to me, and probably a surprise to a lot of people, that team across town where you live, the Oakland Raiders, they're right in the mix for an AFC wildcard spot. What is the most impressive aspect about how they've done what they've done in compiling a 5-4 record?
It seems like they have one kind of smoke, and yet they have a terrible defense, and so they really shouldn't be winning this many games. I mean, in the NFL, you need versatility. In the NFL, you need to be able to, you know, kind of mix things up and throw a bunch of different pitches at a guy. But they're just kind of throwing the same curveball every single time, and turns out teams can't really hit it all that well. They're kind of going by the skin of their teeth and just getting by week after week. But you know what? The AFC is so bad, I don't know if it's really going to matter. They might actually make the playoffs. They got the Bengals this week. They have the Jets the week following. They're going to go into December in a game against the Kansas City Chiefs in Kansas City, who, by the way, they're struggling right now. They can't seem to stop anybody on defense either. I think that the Raiders are going to go into December at 7-4. I mean, it blows my mind because, again, they're just, if they don't have Josh Jacobs running the ball, they don't stand a chance. If they don't convert on a preternatural number of third downs, they don't stand a chance. And they don't stand a chance every time they take the field on defense. So that's kind of the NFL in a nutshell in 2019 and going forward, where no one plays any defense and you kind of see if you can get it done in opportune spots on the offensive end. But the schedule was really tough for them early in the season. They had, I think, 40-something games away from home, or 40-something days. Games would be incredible. away from home. They got through it. And now they kind of are set up to really succeed. That December 1 game against the Chiefs, should they not, already kind of show that they're probably not right for the scenario with a loss to the Bengals or the Jets, but that December 1 game against the Chiefs is just, like, incredible. And having seen them play in Week 2, I would never have suggested that game would actually mean something, that game could mean that the AFC West was on the line. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it does seem ridiculous, but that's where we are. And what's more surprising to me, and maybe it's not if you live there like you do and you have a better feel from it, from the outside looking in, we know this team is leaving for Vegas. And we know of all the fights they've had with the Coliseum and this bizarre relationship that's gone on. And yet, I watch those games at home, and those fans, despite knowing that team is leaving them, are wrapping their arms around John Gruden and this Raiders team. Why are they able to embrace it, even though they know it's going?
Well, let's be totally honest here. Raiders fans aren't exactly the most logical people. They root for a completely, just a preposterous team in general. The fan base itself isn't necessarily just located in Oakland. We're already dealing with a Bay Area that has, two teams in it. We're dealing with an East Bay community that has a lot of new people coming in. Most of the fan base for the Raiders is sort of just ambiguous California, and people drive in from all over. They still have a huge presence in L.A. You have the Fresno contingent coming up for Derek Carr that he won over. Oakland itself probably isn't strong enough to hold the team together, I guess, as we're learning. And there's probably as many 49ers fans, if not more 49ers fans, in the East Bay than there are Raiders fans. So it's always been sort of this international house of pancakes at the Coliseum, just with people coming in from everywhere. And I don't think that that's going to change at all in Vegas. I think that they're going to be successful in Vegas. Ultimately, the reason that people aren't thinking about the fact that, hey, this team is leaving at the end of the year is because they've been bad for so many years in this century that just seeing marginal competence, you can't help but get excited. You've had to sit through so many crappy games. When they finally play well, you're not going to let cognitive dissonance get in the way. You're not going to let the memory that, hey, this team is abandoning this community get in the way if you are somebody from this community who is a Raiders fan. So, they really have been long suffering and waiting for this. And I think ultimately everyone's talked themselves into the notion that the Coliseum's a dump. They were never going to get a new stadium because Mark Davis is too poor to build a new stadium without almost $1 billion in the state helping him and NFL holding his hand. The way that the A's stadium deal is going down, it's only proven further that it was never going to happen for the Raiders here. Vegas is a very short and cheap flight away for everybody. Most people are traveling anyway. So it just doesn't feel as monumental. But, yeah, I mean, this season, if you can't cheer for it, if you can't just enjoy the moment, you're just not going to have very much fun at all at a Raiders game. And you're probably very drunk anyway. So, what are we really talking about here?
Great stuff, Dieter. I always enjoy the conversation, and I do think that should be their new slogan for 2019. Oakland Raiders. Marginal competence. You should suggest that to them.
We'll see if they can get that marginal competence over the Bengals and Jets. It's going to be fun.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, and we'll do this again soon.
Absolutely. Talk soon.
That is Dieter Kurtenbach from the Bay Area News Group. Here's the thing, and I'm not a Raiders guy whatsoever. Grew up actually cheering for anybody playing the Raiders. Don't care, just don't like the Raiders. And yes, I like the team across town. I'm a Niners guy, so that has something to do with it. here's the great thing that I think we can all take from what's happening in Oakland. Living in the moment. Those fans are living in the moment. We talk about it all the time, but what do we end up doing? We end up worrying about the future. Yeah, okay, this is going good right now, but what about what happens in this month? Or what about getting to the playoffs? Or just live in the moment. Have fun. Just enjoy whatever it is for what it is right then. I'm kind of envious of that attitude right now with Raiders fans. That they're not worried about the fact their team's leaving. That they're not bitter with ownership to the point where they won't go celebrate what they're seeing with a team that they've grown up loving. I actually admire that. I think it's a great thing that sports fans can take. Because we're always too worried about, well, yeah, we're winning, but are we winning enough? Can we win a championship? And if we don't, does it really matter? We should be having the bottom fall out. We should be drafted. Just enjoy it for what it is. Just have fun with it. That's what the Raiders and their fans are doing. As mentioned, Week 11 kicks off tonight in Cleveland. Steelers, another surprise team in the AFC, taking on the Browns. Well, you know it makes a difference, but how much of a difference does it make? Brian Burke answers that question next right here on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Welcome to the Scott Rintoul Show.
What's going on? How's your Thursday going so far? Scott Rintoul with you, getting you through it here, at least the morning portion. Thanks for joining us. We're hoping to connect with Brendan Morrison at the bottom of this hour. I don't know where he is in rural Alberta, in the wilderness of Alberta, but somewhere out there, the great outdoorsman, we're trying to track him down. We talked about this yesterday. We're hoping it's going to happen. We'll see. I don't know if he's going to be anywhere where he can get cell service. If so, he will be on the show at the bottom of the hour. If not, we'll get Mo on again next week, and we'll see if we can call the next man up. Hey, this happens in your lineup. Something happens, somebody's got to step up. Who can jump up into Brendan Morrison's spot at the bottom of this hour? We'll wait and see. Great stat coming out last night from NHL PR. And it's infuriating probably for coaches who get the lead, but it's fantastic as hockey fans to watch the games. So far, there has been a comeback win on 42 of 44 days in the NHL. Last night, it was the Blackhawks coming back on the Golden Knights. There have only been 2 days in this entire calendar of hockey where a team hasn't come back when it was trailing in a game. And there have been some fantastic ones that we can all remember, or heartbreaking ones, depending which side of it you're on. The Capitals coming back from 5-1 down against the Canucks. The Bruins blowing a 4-0 lead against the Florida Panthers the other day. This happens all over the place now, and it's a lot of fun. I just love that number, and I love the fact that that's where we're at with the regular season hockey right now. The other big news coming out from the NHL after last night's Skedden. Yeah, we can talk about what the Islanders did. That looked like such a fun environment, by the way. That looked so much fun last night in New York. Matt Barzal was jacked up when he scored that opening goal. Can't tell me he's getting that fired up for just a regular game. It means a little something. I don't think there's animosity with the players in that case with John Tavares, but it just is fun to be in those kinds of environments. It's one of the comments that Canucks fans have talked about throughout the course of this year. Win or lose, and it's been mostly win at home. This is a team that only has one regulation loss. There's an energy back in the arena that hasn't been there for a while. And when you have that, you have to embrace it. I mentioned this with the Raiders fans, what's going on there this year, and how they're just having so much fun in that stadium, even though their team's leaving. You just don't know when that feeling's going to go. And all of a sudden, you have a sterile environment relative to what you've had before. So you have to embrace it when it happens. And big games are usually the draw for that, or your team winning, or a combination of the two. Unfortunately, despite the fact this NHL star did the right thing, it's going to cost us here in Western Canada. Sidney Crosby, as you may have heard, went under the knife. He has a core muscle issue. He's had it surgically repaired. That's the right decision. Apparently, he's been weighing this over the last few days. Do I just try to rehab through this and do as best I can, or do I go under the knife? He made the right decision here. They need Sidney Crosby for the second half of this year. And with Malkin now back in the lineup and the way that team has gutted things out and the emergence of Jared McCann in that lineup, The Penguins just need to be able to tread water, and then they get their big guy back. He made the right call, but that's what hurts us here in Western Canada. It means we don't get to see Sidney Crosby this year. Penguins roll through next month, through Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver. Crosby's not going to be a part of that. Disappointing, but understandable. I'm not going to go down the whole load management road now. That's not the conversation this is about, because this, to me, while it's disappointing, for most sports fans, they find this as acceptable. Oh, okay, this guy's beat up to the point where he had to have surgery. I already bought my ticket for the Pittsburgh Penguins game, but while I'm disappointed, I find this a legitimate reason, as opposed to the conversation we've been having about load management. If you're a fan, well, what do you mean the guy's just taking the night off because he wants to rest or because they think it's best that he plays a game later this week? There's a much different feel to the two. But yeah, it's disappointing that we're not going to see Sidney Crosby. Brian Burke was on the airwaves this morning in Vancouver, and I thought he initiated for me what is a very interesting discussion, and I want you in on this as well. You've got the text message numbers. You've got my Twitter handle, at Scott Rintoul. Brian Burke was posed this question. How much difference does coaching make in the NHL? And really it was put to him, you know, of all the sports, because it's such a free-flowing game and so player-dependent, how much of a difference does coaching make, or does it make much of one at all? And here's what he had to say.
In terms of preparation and motivation and how you play, I for sure. And I know what you're saying. I think the guy that has the least impact is a manager in baseball, because I think, you know, and they still have a huge impact. But to me, you know, the year we won the Cup, Randy Carlyle was the best coach in the league. He just did a marvelous job. Mark Crawford did a marvelous job for me in Vancouver. These are guys that, you know, that make a difference. They can get guys going. They know who to distribute ice time to. They know how to juggle lines if they need to do that. And I think Barry Trotz is obviously he's a hell of a coach, but there's a lot of noise that he might win Coach of the Year again this year.
And I want to hear the follow-up from Burke on that, because I think it is an important one to put this conversation in context. And here's what I want your response on, and I'll discuss this on the other side of hearing Brian Burke talk about Barry Trotz and the Islanders. What makes a good head coach in today's NHL? What is it? But first, here's Burke expanding on those thoughts about what is going on in Long Island over the course of last season and here early in this campaign.
Well, I think they're the real thing for a couple reasons. One, when Barry Trotz went in there a year ago, he reduced their goals against total by 100 goals. 100 goals. And so, you know, that's impossible. I don't know if it's ever been done or ever will be done again. So they have, if you watch them play, there's always a layer between you and a teammate. So they contest really every inch of the ice. They forechecks aggressively. So it's the defensive scheme they have, and the goaltending's been superb. So, no, I think they're legit for sure. I think it's when you say what do they need, I'm not sure they need anything. I mean, I think they haven't lost some regulation in 11 games.
Yeah.
There's a team that went to the playoffs last year, a team that won a round in the playoffs last year, and a team that many of us, myself included, thought may take a step back this season. Are they going to be able to replicate that? Are they all going to have the same buy-in to that same defensive approach? And the return so far, extremely positive. And congratulations to Barry Trotz, who we knew was a good coach, but has further emboldened our opinion on that with what he's done in Long Island. It's incredible. I can remember when Trotz eventually got fired in Nashville, and he was up for a number of jobs, including the one in Vancouver. People wondered, would they bring in Barry Trotz? If you hearken back to those times, do you remember what everybody said about Barry Trotz? I don't know if he can coach offense. I don't know if they can have an offensive team under Barry Trotz. I mean, look at Nashville. They never scored. They played this defensive hockey. Yeah, they got to the playoffs a couple of times, but they never really went anywhere. And if you're going to put him in a situation where he's got guys that need to score a bunch and that's the style of team you're operating, it's never going to work. And then he goes to Washington, and look what he does with that team. Eventually gets them over the hump. Didn't happen overnight, but I don't think Washington suffered for offense with Barry Trotz there. The New York Islanders, they certainly don't have the same type of roster composition as the Capitals. But that guy, he's a great coach because he adapts to what he has, and he gets the most out of what he has. And that's the conversation I want to have. What makes a good head coach in today's NHL? Is it tactical? Is it a motivator? Is it a great communicator? Are those one and the same? What to you makes a great head coach in today's NHL? And I want to talk great, not good, because if you look around the NHL right now, maybe this is just our nature as hockey fans. How many teams do you say, oh, their head coach is no good? That guy can't coach. It's not easy to do. There might be teams that you're not sure about. I don't know if DJ Smith's a great head coach. I don't really know. It's his first time doing it. I know he doesn't have a very good roster. So how am I supposed to decide whether or not DJ Smith is a good head coach? Probably have to listen to what the players say. Probably have to talk to Ottawa media who watch their games day in, day out. Is he getting the most out of his roster? I think that's the barometer I use. With what you have, because a lot of this is on the GM as well, with what you have, are you able to extract the most out of it? And how do you go about doing that? But look around the league. Are there a lot of guys that you go, that guy can't coach? Jeff Blashill's name got thrown out in our pre-show discussion today. Well, everybody thought he did a really good job in Grand Rapids, and he doesn't have much to work with in Detroit. So is he a good head coach with just a bad team? Is he an average head coach? I don't know. I'm not sure. You have to give these guys something to work with. Travis Green in Vancouver is a very good example of this. In my opinion, Travis Green has gotten the most he could out of the last two rosters he's had, despite the fact they were nowhere good enough to be really competitive in the NHL. This is the first year that he's had a legitimate roster that he can compete with. So we get a better idea of how to gauge his level of coaching. I think he's a really good head coach. Everybody who talks about the Canucks seems to say Travis Green's got that thing headed the right direction. I really like what he's doing there. But now we get to find out because he has a legitimate roster. Get in on the conversation. I want to play this for you as well before we get to some of your comments. What makes a great head coach in today's hockey? Tony Granato was on earlier in the week, and we know the impact young players are having on the league now relative to what it was 10, 15, 20 years ago. So while Tony is coaching right now at the college level, he has been an NHL head coach, and he understands that you can't do things the same way today that you did then. And young players are a very good example of this and the dialogue you need to have with them.
I love what you just said because I think that's so important. For me to understand. The good thing for me is I play with Gretzky. I play with Robitaille and Curry and Coffey and Larry Robinson. I give you a list of players and go on and on. And the guys that I played with were that caliber and that level of Hall of Fame type of players. And then I coached, you know, Sakic and Forsberg and Hajduk and Blake and Patrick Waugh. And then I went to Pittsburgh and had Crosby and Malkin and those guys. And I went to Detroit and had Datsyuk and Zetterberg. So I've had enough players that I've watched and been able to learn from and kind of listen to. And what you just said for me is really important as a coach with these younger players. It's a different generation of players. They learn differently than the players that I played with and coached and had just mentioned. And it's important for me to adjust to them. But the listening part and the discussion part is always something that will be part of my philosophy as a coach. Is I got to hear the players, and I got to hear what they see and what they feel. And if you can understand them a little bit differently than you would when you were playing, I think it's really important for me as a coach, you know, to try to develop and grow as a coach and try to help these guys grow at the pace that they need to be ready for their next challenge.
And to me, that's so essential with where we're at with the game. Yeah, you've got a lot of knowledge as a coach. You've got a lot of wisdom. And there are so many things you can teach these young players. But knowing and being comfortable with yourself to admit that you don't have all of the answers and you don't know everything, and these players may have something they can give you that you've never thought of before, and that communication process, that's at the heart of it. That's where you build these relationships and ultimately do what I think you need to prove your worth as a coach. Get the most out of what you have. Brad in Burnaby sends this in. A great head coach gets more out of the whole than is present in the sum of the parts. No question. Absolutely. And we can talk about the different types of coaches. I do think there are some that can get you to a certain level, but maybe they can't get you over the top. I think generally most coaches, that's a fallacy, but I think there are some, like Daryl Sutter. I don't know if Daryl Sutter is the type of coach, and He's not coaching right now, but is Daryl Sutter the type of coach that can take a young team, watch it evolve, and then see it through to the end goal of ultimately winning? I'm not sure. I know Daryl Sutter's a finisher. I know if you give Daryl Sutter a team that's kind of knocking on the door of the playoffs or not quite getting in or getting booted in the first round time and time again, I know that guy has proven he can get a team over the top. Bruce Boudreau has the opposite criticism of him, that Bruce Boudreau has been good enough to get his team into the playoffs almost every single year, but then can't get them past that point. And I'm not sure what that is. I don't know if that's tactical. I don't know if that's motivation at that point. I'm not sure. But that's been the knock on Bruce Boudreau, and yet every time he finds himself out at work, somebody wants him in. Probably because they know how hard it is to get into the playoffs these days, and if you get in, you got a chance. Continue to send us your feedback. Would love to get you in on the conversation as well. What they're saying coming up in just a matter of moments. I do want to mention this one topic from the NFL. Varying reports coming out as to whether or not the NFL and its players are getting close to agreeing on a CBA. Apparently, the NFL is leaking out, yes, we are, and players aren't so sure that they're getting that close. Bottom line is this. 17-game schedule is one of the big talking points. It seems as though that's where we're headed, that they're going to add one extra game, they're going to diminish the preseason. I think most fans like that. But where this is applicable to us on this side of the border is that with that possibility, there's speculation out there that that 17th game for every team would be a neutral site game. You'd still have your 8 home games, you'd still have your 8 away games, and then there'd be a neutral site game. Yeah, London's going to get more games. Mexico City probably going to get more games. But if you're in Canada and you're in one of at least 3 markets, maybe 4, that might sound okay to you. Where can they play their games? Travel's not that bad. Need a stadium of a certain size. I know. Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, maybe Edmonton. More weather dependent there. You'd have to do it earlier in the year. But those are 4 stadiums not that far that could host neutral site games. Start wrapping your head around that. That is a possibility if that's where the NFL goes. And do you want your city bidding for one? I would think the answer is a no-brainer, yes. I'm not sure how it plays in Montreal, but I'm guessing people would go out. I know in Vancouver that would play. Toronto, yeah, the Bills thing kind of fizzled, but they screwed that up with the way they marketed it and the way they priced it at the time. It was less about the fact it was an NFL team and more about all of the stuff and lack of bells and whistles, and felt like they were trying to gouge at the time as well. And that didn't go over particularly well. Neutral site game, you knew one was coming. I think enough people would be in. But that's a possibility coming to a stadium near you. Let's do it. We do it every day around 10:15, 11:15. What they're saying.
What are you talking about, man?
What are you saying?
Not saying anything.
You're saying something?
I guess that's what I'm saying, Brooksy.
Here's what they're saying.
A lot of awards getting handed out in the last couple of days in Major League Baseball. They handed out Rookie of the Year and second in Rookie of the Year voting in the National League, Calgary native Mike Soroka. He was lights out for the Atlanta Braves this year. Simply fantastic. Won his playoff start as well. In fact, the criticism of the Braves was you probably should have found a way to pitch him more in that series than just the one time. He was on for an extended interview yesterday with Pinder and Steinberg in Calgary and was asked this question. How do you go about improving on a rookie season that saw you finish second in NL rookie voting? And he actually finished sixth in Cy Young voting as well. I found this to be a very compelling answer.
I think a lot of people are afraid of making adjustments after they've seen success. That was the old traditional way of when something works, don't try and do anything else. Just stick with it. But the problem with that now is that the way the league's going with analytics and research that they can do on you, hitters are making adjustments quicker than ever. So for me, it's about looking at what I need to adjust on and making plans that I need to go into next season to maybe tweak a little bit. I consider that to be one of my strengths, to be able to go out there and switch it up. I know people say, yeah, the sinker's my one, but it doesn't mean that I need to live and die by it at every second. You know, I try and value my other pitches just as much to be able to go out there and say, this isn't going today. This isn't sinking. you know, screw it, we're going to go back to the four seam and the changeup. And so that's going to be things looking forward to next year. And how can I make those better? So it's truly complete.
I love the checkers versus chess conversation, the strategy conversation in all of sports. And that's one that Mike Soroka got across to me yesterday. Okay, I had this great year, and I know the effectiveness of my pitches, and I know what my best pitch is, and I know generally how I'm going to approach hitters. But here's what else I know. We live in this age of analytics. We live in an age where hitters get a stat sheet, they get all of the numbers presented to them, and they are told by their hitting coaches, by their managers, okay, here's the approach against this guy this day. This is what we do because this is what the numbers tell us to do. So do that. Well, Soroka, with the knowledge that hitters are going to approach him that way, realizes that he has to adapt his game as well. So, pardon the pun, but what curveball does he throw their way? Okay, I look back at my season and I see that generally when I had success, here was my approach. Well, everybody else now knows that as well. How do I alter that approach so that I can have success next year? This is a young guy who's talking about this on the fly early in his career. I find it a fascinating conversation when it comes to strategy, whether it's baseball or hockey or football, whatever it is. But baseball is so analytically driven. There's a great article out today talking about all of the numbers, how this is the 14th consecutive year that strikeouts are up. 14 consecutive years. Are the pitchers that much better? No, probably not. Nope. There's some really good ones, but there always have been. But that's just difference in plate approach, and that a strikeout isn't viewed as a poor plate appearance the way it used to be viewed. And that's where we're at. And I like hearing that from Soroka as well, because there is this sterile feel to baseball right now where the human element has been taken out. And, well, here's what the numbers say you have to do, so that's what you do. And there's less decision-making on the parts of pitchers or batters. At least that's the way it feels. So when I hear that human element and I hear that strategic conversation that's going on that's not all simply statistically driven, and I understand why the analytics work over such a big sample size as well, I get it. I understand why people invest in it and why they do it, because it works. But you don't want the human element completely taken out at all. Really good stuff with Mike Soroka. If you want more of that interview, you can find it, sportsnet.ca/960. To hear that extended conversation. Thought we better get this in as well. I'm certainly not the biggest fan of this team, not going to claim to be, but it was a pretty amazing phenomenon what happened here in the last 6 months, and yet people have written this team off completely. The Toronto Raptors won again last night. They won in Portland. Here's Pascal Siakam after the game.
For us, it's been, you know, battles after battles, so I think it just shows that the toughness of the team, and banged up, we just don't give up, and we're going to continue to go out there every single day, give our best effort. Whatever comes after that, you know, we can't control it.
They won again last night. They're 8-3 on the season. They're second in the Eastern Conference right now, and regular season success has certainly become commonplace in Toronto. That's what they do. That's what they've done forever. But they lost Kawhi Leonard. They don't have Kyle Lowry and Serge Ibaka playing right now. And they're on a West Coast swing. They beat the Lakers in L.A. They beat Portland last night in Portland. And that's a playoff team from a year ago. I know Portland's off to a miserable start. Toronto, here's what I take from it. Not only do they have probably better talent than we've given them credit for, Nick Nurse can coach, man. Nick Nurse can flat out coach. Nice start for them. Going to be an interesting story to follow here in their follow-up season after the championship. One that nobody thinks are anywhere near without Kawhi Leonard. We're going to try to track down Brendan Morrison next. I want to know what the most hostile environment he ever played in the NHL was. I saw it with John Tavares last night in Long Island. What about for Mo? If we can get him, you'll hear him next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Will he or won't he? It's the question we're asking right now. Maybe you're asking the same one. Brendan Morrison, be in cell reception. If he is, you're going to hear him here in the next few minutes. If he's not, you're going to have to wait until next week, until we reconvene with the former Canuck, former Flame, among the many teams he played for. Scott Rentoul with you. This is the Scott Rentoul Show. Always interactive. Get your text messages in. You can find me on Twitter at Scott Rentoul. I rolled that stat out at the beginning of the hour. 42 of 44 days thus far in the NHL season, we've seen a comeback victory. Last night it happened in a place that I'm surprised it happened. Vegas Golden Knights were up 2-0 on the Chicago Blackhawks, who suddenly are playing better hockey. They're even on the season now, 7-7-4. Seem to have gotten things together, at least in the recent past. 2-0, Marc-Andre Fleury in Vegas. I'm surprised they blew that lead. I really am. They end up losing this game 5-3. And Vegas feels a little like Tampa to me right now. I'm not really concerned, but I'm kind of waiting for things to go. I'm surprised they don't have more wins, more points than they do right now. I'm still not at the point where I'm saying, uh-oh, watch out, like San Jose, for example. San Jose, there are just so few points accrued right now that the math tells you you better be worried. We all know what St. Louis did a year ago. We all know what's possible, but we also know what's probable. And I look at San Jose, and I see a minus 13 goal differential. I look at Vegas, and I'm surprised they're minus two. That's a result of last night, even though they're one game above 500. But that feels like a team that has an extra gear. That feels like a team that's going to find its way. Tampa Bay is the exact same. Tampa Bay, I'm surprised they've given up 52 goals already in 15 games. But look at the talent on that roster. Things should start to come around. They're a veteran team that knows the different levels you have to ascend to during the course of a season. I feel like that's going to work out. There's other teams that I'm not quite sure what's holding them back right now. And we're either going to ask Brendan Morrison about that or John Mattis of The Score about that, national hockey writer. The Calgary Flames are a curiosity to me right now. And I think you can look at them in a similar vein as the Dallas Stars, even though the Stars have been a lot more streaky. So Calgary, here's the good news. The good news is you're 10-8-3, and you're sitting in a playoff spot right now, and you haven't played great hockey overall. You can't win more than two games in a row, but you can't lose more than two games in a row. There's something consistent about that, but there's also something a little meh about being in the middle all the time. Dallas has been quite the opposite. Dallas plummets at the start of the season, and now they're griping about how they've gotten to 8-1-1 in their last 10 games. They haven't gotten any contribution really from Tyler Seguin or Jamie Benn. So great. The good news in Dallas, you're winning a lot of games. You're 8-1-1 in your last 10. The bad news, do we think that's possible to continue if two of your big guns aren't firing right now? Jamie Benn looked a lot better last night, hit a post last night, was more dangerous last night. But at some point, there's got to be a bottom line. And his head coach called him out on the weekend. He's apparently fine with it, and winning masks a lot of that. But I'm interested to know what's holding a team like Calgary back. What do you see with the Calgary Flames? Is it a lack of work ethic? Is it a lack of spark? I know the guys this morning in Calgary, Boomer and company kicking things around, Corey Sarris, he said, I don't know what that it factor is, but I can't see it right now. I just don't seem to be able to find an it factor game in, game out. And there are teams where you see it. The team in Vancouver, there is that it factor about it. Not that they're one of the best teams in the NHL, but there's this confidence that you can see on the ice with the way they conduct themselves, with the work ethic they have, game in, game out. Arizona has that as well. Arizona isn't a particularly sexy team. Not a particularly sexy team, but they're effective. They're 11-6-2, and they've got that same it factor. They seem to be able to get the job done, and there's a belief and a buy-in, and I don't know how you quantify that, but Arizona has it right now. Vancouver has it right now. I think Vegas will see it. I think Tampa Bay will see it. Some of the other teams I mentioned, I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Did we track down Brendan Morrison, Raja? I'm not sure if we did. But we've got John Mattis on the line right now. Great. We'll talk some hockey with John Mattis. We'll leave Brendan Morrison to go about his outdoors activities, and we will talk to John Mattis, national writer for The Score, talking hockey. John, thank you very much for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing very well. I was just talking about the Calgary Flames, and they haven't lost a lot in a row, but they haven't won a lot in a row. There are a couple wins here, a couple losses there. What's standing in the way of Calgary starting to get on a roll?
Well, from my perspective, and I haven't done a deep dive on this, but just big picture, it seems like, you know, they take the odd period off and it really burns them. Like, you'll watch a game and it's like, oh, things are going okay, and then second period, not so much, and instead of the team that they're playing scoring one goal, they score two or three, and all of a sudden it's off the rails. So, I don't know. Last year they started off, you know, kind of mediocre, similar to this year. So I don't really see it as, you know, this situation where the sky is falling. I think that on paper, I mean, if you look at the Pacific Division, they should be battling for top spot. So, and you don't look at their roster right now and what players have produced and go, you know, certain guys are letting them down. I think it's just sort of a collective, I guess, rest that they take sometimes and take full periods off, and that's kind of been in the butt so far. So I don't know. There's no one to really point a finger at individually, at least, you know, from my perspective. I just think that they're working out their kinks right now, and I guess it's better to do that at the beginning of the year than towards the end. And you know, history showed us with last year that they're able to turn this thing around. And you know, you got Mark Giordano over there, who's one of the best leaders in the game. So I have no sort of worries about their season thus far.
In theory, everything you said I agree with, and it's a reason I think Calgary is going to be a playoff team and has the roster composition to be there as well. But I heard something interesting in the end, at the middle of that answer, where you said, hey, they should be competing for top spot in the Pacific Division. That top spot's going to be a lot harder to come by this year. I think most of us assigned it to Vegas, a team that also I think will get going here eventually. But Vancouver looks like they're going to be here to stay. Arizona looks like they're going to be here to stay. How much better is this division going to be by season's end than you thought coming in?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment to make, because Oilers people before the season are going, you know, they're going to kind of push for a playoff spot, but are they going to be leading the Pacific half or quarter of the way through? I don't think anyone predicted that. So the fact that they're up there and they have to be kind of knocked down a few pegs in order for the teams that we thought would be leading the division to take over, that's going to take a while. It's not going to happen overnight. They've done well for themselves. And the Coyotes, I mean, we've been waiting for this team to kind of turn the corner for a number of years, and you can blame injuries and you can blame, you know, bad luck, all that stuff, but they just haven't been able to put it together over a full 82 games. And it's still early, and it's not like they're hitting this thing out of the park, but they put themselves in a pretty good position after about 20 games here. So those two jump off the page, and then obviously the Canucks, they're exceeding expectations at the moment. I mean, obviously it hasn't been a perfect season, especially, you know, a couple losses of late, but overall you got to be happy if you're a Canucks fan. So you start going down the list and you finally get to Vegas, who are really, I think, the toast of the division, at least in regards to who should win the division. And you could have lumped in the Sharks as well at the beginning of the season, but we know that that's gone very poorly for them. So, yeah, I mean, you look at every single team and there's sort of a different story happening there. I think the Ducks and the Kings are probably not going to, you know, challenge anyone for a playoff spot. But after that, it's very kind of a yo-yo season where some of the teams that we thought would be maybe challenging for a wild card are actually leading the division. And then the teams that we thought were going to be leading the division are kind of in the wild card race, or in, you know, the Sharks situation, kind of trying to figure out what to do. If are they going to blow it up? Or are they going to kind of power through this terrible start to the season? So they got some question marks there. But, yeah, the division is totally up for grabs.
John Mattis, national hockey writer for The Score, joining me here on the Scott Rintoul Show. Specifically with the Vancouver Canucks, I think we can all agree there's something there that's going to allow them to remain in this race and maybe push them into the playoffs this year. What is it specifically about the way they play, John, that causes you to say, that's the thing I like most about their chances?
Good question. I think at this point in time, like just looking at their history as a franchise and how things have gone in the last couple of years, I'm going to point towards goaltending just because I think Jacob Markstrom's actually a pretty good starter. I think that he doesn't get the credit he deserves, and Thatcher Demko's turned into a decent backup, obviously the goalie of the future there. So I'm going to say that they might be the X factor. You know that Elias Pettersson is going to produce. You know that Bo Horvat's going to be a quality second center. You know that Brock Besser is going to put pucks in the net, and that a guy like Quinn Hughes is going to keep climbing on the trajectory that he's on and maybe challenge for the Calder. Like, they've got a lot going on for them, and they added in the summer, and some of those additions people, you know, raised eyebrows about, and barely, you know, Tyler Marris, for example, that long extension. But you can't deny the fact that adding more talent to a team in the short term is going to turn out well, and you've seen that with, obviously, JT Miller. So I think that they're a pretty good team. I think at the beginning of the season I was pegging them as a team that would be right in the race for a playoff spot at the end of the year if all things went well. And that's kind of where they are right now, and I think that it'll be interesting to see how the goalies develop over time and how they factor into the wins and losses here.
I think it's a very good point you make, because the emergence of Thatcher Demko really changes the way you can look at the position just this year moving forward. It's a fascinating discussion to have about what the Vancouver Canucks do with that situation. And it's juxtaposed by what is happening in Toronto right now. Elliot Friedman wrote yesterday in his 31 thoughts, or this week I should say in his 31 thoughts, hey, they're not sweating it too much. They're not sweating this goaltending situation. I would counter with this. How can they not be sweating this goaltending situation in Toronto right now, John?
Well, I would totally agree. I'm on your side, Scott. Like, it's a major issue, and I know that things are going to amplify in Toronto and get blown out of proportion. And I'm not saying that it's not getting blown out of proportion, but it is an issue for a team that is so highly skilled and has an excellent number one goalie. They need someone that can stop a puck as their backup. And mind you, is Hutchinson to blame solely for all their back-to-back losses? Or, sorry, losses in the second game of back-to-backs? No, because that's a terrible situation to put a goalie in. But there comes a time when a backup's got to, you know, put up, or they end up on waivers. So they're in a weird situation here where they don't have much money to spend, if any at all. There aren't a lot of teams that are looking forward to helping out the Toronto Maple Leafs and kind of giving them a freebie of sorts. Like, it's going to be tough, because a big storyline in Toronto over the last couple of years has been Freddie Anderson's workload. And, you know, he's never, you know, kind of fallen apart in the playoffs or been terrible, but there's always been that sort of underlying storyline of, like, well, if they didn't play him so much in the regular season, maybe this team, you know, advances to the second round. Maybe it's that little 1% because he's got that extra sort of edge to him. So, I mean, that's a big issue. I mean, they obviously need to make the playoffs first, and I believe that they will, but from there, is Freddie Anderson going to be ready? Because that's really what this all boils down to with the backup goalie is, are they able to put a guy out there that can win a game or two here and there, can kind of stabilize while Freddie Anderson has his rest?
With that team specifically, I think it's a legitimate question to ask. What's a bigger concern? How they handle that goaltending balance for the rest of the year and get him fresh and ready if possible, or the style you need to play to win in the playoffs and whether their roster is constructed well enough to do so? What do you think the bigger concern is?
Well, I think I'm a big proponent of kind of going against the grain, or going, you know, against sort of tradition, so to speak. So that's what Kyle Dubas has done here. He's decided to, you know, go all in on speed and skill, which isn't a terrible idea. I mean, let's face it, the game's all about speed and skill now. Now, we've seen, obviously, a lot of teams falter in the playoffs because they didn't have enough of that that grit, or that toughness, or that edge to them. So the jury's out on that, but I would honestly be more concerned with the goaltending situation than the style of play, because I just feel like the more skill you can accumulate in your organization, the better off you are. And we'll see if that becomes true over time with the Maple Leafs, because it's an interesting case study. But I don't hate this idea that Kyle Dubas is got behind and really, like, drove home. I mean, I don't know if we've seen a team that's fully invested as much in skill as we've seen with the Leafs, at least that come to mind immediately. Like, they are just – there's very little in regards to toughness or guys who, you know, forecheck hard and those sort of stereotypes of grinders on that team. I mean, Zach Hyman coming back last night was a huge storyline in Toronto because they had no one to get pucks for them. So you know, there's sort of different ways to look at it, but I'm very interested to see how the all-in on skill thing goes. So I'd say I'm more concerned with that.
John Mattis, national hockey writer for The Score, joining me here. Talking some puck on the Scott Rintoul Show. What's a tougher division to survive in right now, the Pacific or the Atlantic?
I say the Atlantic just because, you know, Boston is just such a juggernaut right now. And then you also have Tampa, that's sort of a sleeping giant. I mean, does anyone think that this record that they have right now is really indicative of the type of team they are? I mean, you could have went around and asked 50 pundits before the season, you know, who's the best team on paper, and I don't know, 40 of them probably would have said Tampa. Like they're just that stat. So you imagine that that's going to come around, and they'll start winning a lot more hockey games. And then the Leafs, they're underperforming too. So you got to factor in the three kind of monsters at the top of that division, and then you have Buffalo that's rising. I think they're a little underrated at this point. Montreal, they're doing pretty good this year, not obviously to the potential that they would like to reach. And, I mean, the bottom of the division isn't great. Let's face it, with the Red Wings, and the Senators. So, I don't know. Like, it's kind of a toss-up, but the Pacific is it seems a little more random. It seems a little more disorganized, whereas the Atlantic clearly has these heavy hitters that, even though maybe, aside from Boston, the results haven't been there, I think that there's no denying the problem in that division.
John, I want to bring it back to the Pacific Division, which is where we started. We talked about Kyle Dubas doing things a little bit differently in Toronto. I think the same can be said with John Chyka in Arizona. You had the opportunity to sit down, talk to him, talk about the process and what's going on in Arizona. What reason is there to believe that this is the start of something, not just another year for the Coyotes in the existence that we've known them to be in?
Well, yeah, that's a perfectly fair question. And I mean, I don't really know the answer to it, to be honest, like even after talking to John Chyka, because they've been out of the playoffs, I think, 7 years. I think they're the second longest drought at this point, the Coyotes. So it's not like this team has anything to sort of hang their hat on or to look back on. Like, it's been a long stretch, and Chyka has been there for, it's his fifth year with the organization, fourth as GM. Like, he's had a pretty long leash here, let's be honest, right? But at the same time, I mean, good for ownership, the new ownership group there that has some deep pockets finally to invest in him and say, hey, we're all on board with your vision here. And that vision seems to be that he wants to load up on defensemen, goalies, and centers. And those are sort of his targets. And you see it with his drafting. You see it with the contracts he hands out, a lot of long-term contracts to players that maybe haven't proven themselves at least fully. A guy like Jacob Chychrun, a good player, but I mean, they gave him a contract a while ago when he was far out from his negotiation kind of pressure point. Same goes for Clayton Keller, a full year out. So he's definitely taking a long-term view to things, even though he's been there for a while, Chyka. And we'll see if that ends up resulting in more wins, but you got to give him credit for finding a fair amount of players via trade. Versus just drafting. I mean, I know that some of them have blown up in his face. There's been the odd trade that hasn't worked out, like the Domi to Montreal for Galchenyuk didn't work out, but he ended up flipping Galchenyuk for Kessel. So you end up sort of, you know, running through his trades and going, it's probably even at the end of the day. But he's taking an approach where it's very long-term. Like, I don't know what year they hope to challenge the Stanley Cup. It seems like it's just an open-ended thing, but they believe that they're really right there in terms of the playoffs, which is a big moment for them to get their fans back involved and back engaged. And I think based on the first 20 games or so, I think they're doing a pretty good job of that. And, you know, what they have right now to be proud of is Darcy Kemper and Antti Raanta, very good 1-2 punches at the goaltending position. So we'll see how things go. I mean, I find Chyka very interesting as a very young guy that's gone on to do, you know, really big things, and he's very confident in his ways and very holistic with how he looks at hockey. So, you know, we talked about a case study in Toronto with all the skill. I mean, there's a case study there in Arizona with sort of hitching your wagon to this young executive and giving him a ton of rope and seeing what happens.
Yeah, John Chyka makes Jeremy Colleton look old. Like, that's how young he is. He makes Colleton look like an old man who's been around forever.
Well, it's crazy, right? Because Chyka's 30 years old right now,
And so he was hired, you know, I believe he was like 26 and 11 months. Like, he was basically 27. And, you know, at 30, he already has all this experience. Like, it's just, it kind of like, it screws with your brain a little bit when you actually think about it. You're like, oh, he's 30, he's the GM, no big deal. And it's like, oh, wait, but he's been the GM for, you know, a number of years here now. So, I mean, I think he's one of those people that, you know, even if things don't work out for him at the NHL level, he'll find a way to make an impact, whether it's in another industry or another sport. Like, he's just one of those sort of whiz kids or like, extremely intelligent people that find a way to succeed. But obviously, it's focused on the Coyotes. And I think that, you know, they deserve a little bit of more opportunity here to see things through, given, you know, the amount of injuries they face and a lot of bodies changing over here.
John, thank you very much for doing this and jumping in on short notice. I really appreciate it. Continue the fine work, sir, and we'll talk again soon.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me on. Have a good one.
That's John Mattis, national hockey writer for The Score. And there are some similarities between what's happening in Arizona and Vancouver. I went over some of those numbers yesterday with you. And just, yeah, the roster is constructed slightly differently. But something John mentions there, what a moment it would be for that organization to get into the playoffs. And there's that similar feeling in Vancouver, that first step for the young players. So in Arizona, the Clayton Kellers of the world, they get in, and now you're opening this whole new world to them. And it's similar a conversation with an Elias Pettersson in Vancouver, Quinn Hughes in Vancouver. What do they take from that? How do they build beyond that? How does that develop them as young players and what that means for your franchise going forward? We all know you get in right now, you can win. It was proven last year, and I know I've hit that line a number of times, but that's just the way it is in the National Hockey League playoffs. But what you learn along the way and what that ends up becoming a year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, extremely important. It's why you see these teams right now say, okay, we're going to cash in some chips because we've been out of this too long, and it affects our development negatively if our players don't end up in the postseason. Plenty more hockey talk coming your way in Calgary right now. This is that part of the day where our roads diverge. You're going to head to Hockey Central in Calgary. It'll feel like that here in Vancouver. It's a game day for the Vancouver Canucks. The Dallas Stars, who played Calgary last night in town, we'll talk about that game, the Benn brothers meeting up, and Travis Green doing something I hoped he would do, and he's doing it. At least it looks like it. That's next on the Scott Rintoul Show.
This is the Scott Rintoul Show.
Besser shoots and scores right off the draw. First career NHL goal, Quinn Hughes.
On the official home of the Canucks.
And it's Markstrom again, this time with the glove.
Elias Pettersson, and shoots, scores!
Sportsnet 650.
So maybe it's nothing. Let's hope it's nothing. Because when I saw him this morning walking into the rink here at Rogers Arena, he was in good spirits. We had a nice conversation on our way up from the parking garage, and I actually joked to him. I actually joked to Bo Horvat. This is Scott Rintoul. This is Scott Rintoul Show, by the way. I joked with him this morning that we were going up one flight. So I saw him head to the elevators. We were coming in slightly different entrances, and he took the elevators up one floor. I took the stairs up one floor. And I joked with him. I said, I guess that 27 minutes the other night took its toll. And he laughed and he said, yeah, I got to save my legs for the game. Bo Horvat left the ice early in the morning skate. It didn't appear as though there was anything, no incident that anybody's reporting right now, but he left the ice early. Everyone else is still there. It might be nothing. It might be nothing. Let's hope it's nothing for Bo Horvat, because this is a team that is down Brandon Sutter right now. This is a team that did not have Jay Beagle out there skating this morning and is already going to go with Tyler Greyevac at center tonight. At least it would appear that way. So let's hope it's nothing with Bo Horvat and that I just felt a little something, didn't feel quite right, wanted to go in early, and he's ready to go for tonight. Maybe he's tired. I don't know. Just because he and I had a quick conversation on the way in doesn't mean I can diagnose whether he's well or not or is at 100%. I have no idea. But let's hope it's nothing. Game day today. Dallas Stars in town. They'll take on the Canucks tonight here at Rogers Arena. Fresh off a 3-1 win over the Calgary Flames last night. Dallas now 8-1-1 in its last 10 games, despite the fact they're not getting much from Jamie Benn. They're not getting much from Tyler Seguin. Their coach kind of called them out on the weekend, then he apologized. It all worked out. Those guys didn't do the scoring last night. Pavelski had a couple of goals, including an empty netter. Justin Dowling was a good story in getting his first NHL goal, which turned out to be the game winner in his hometown of Calgary. So, assuming Bo Horvat, it's nothing and this was no big deal. This is how they skated this morning. Travis Green is doing something I wondered if he'd do. I kind of hoped he would do, and it looks like he's doing it if Bo Horvat's good enough to go. So for the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to assume that until I'm told otherwise. Pettersson, Besser, Levo. You saw that the other night? That's the way they skated this morning at practice. Horvat was centering these two guys. Tanner Pearson, who scored a couple of goals last game, and Jake Virtanen. And here's why that's significant. Adam Gaudette, who draws in at center because Brandon Sutter is out, is centering Sven Berchi and JT Miller. And my question coming into today, and we talked about this yesterday on Canuck Central, and Bick Nazar and I will continue to do that here. I believe we're going to be joined by Israel Fair in the noon hour on Canuck Central as well. And we'll have this discussion. The reason I wanted to know if Travis Green would do that is this. If Brandon Sutter isn't one of your centers, and Adam Gaudette is, we know which one of them has more offensive upside, and we know which one of them is far stronger defensively. So if Adam Gaudette is not a guy you're going to trust as a matchup guy, a shutdown guy, anything like that, you have to allow him to have some offensive talent around him on his wings. That's how you're going to get the most out of him. That's my opinion. Travis Green appears to share that. That's a pretty, well, potentially anyway, dangerous-looking line. That's a line that you say, okay, that can produce something. JT Miller's going to go play there? All right, they're giving Gaudette a little experience on that line. Berchi's a guy who seemed to have some chemistry with Gaudette in the preseason. They looked really good together, especially in that final preseason game that they were together. And Miller and Berchi combined for a couple of opportunities the other night, despite the fact Berchi wasn't able to find the back of the goal. Berchi, Gaudette, Miller. I still like Miller on the top line with Pettersson and Besser, but here's what I'm more invested in, and obviously Travis Green is, assuming Bo Horvat can play in this game tonight. He's invested in the fact that Adam Gaudette now is a guy and a line he's going to look to produce offense for him. And that's a development for this team. And it's also an admission that, yeah, by putting Pearson and Horvat and Virtanen together, we're expecting that to be a line that isn't always looking to generate offense. It could score, but that's not what it's solely dependent on, and that's not what we're really relying on that line for either. The fourth line, by the way, Schaller, Grajovic, Eriksson. That's the way they lined up this morning. Zach McEwen was the extra skater. No change on the back end. Why would there be? That six-pack's been pretty good together during the course of the season. Get in on the conversation. If Bo Horvat can't play, and again, I'm not going down that road yet. It's just notable that he left practice early this morning. Grajovac jumped in between Pearson and Virtanen. Roussel jumped in, centering Schaller and Eriksson. We know he's not playing tonight. I would assume, and again, this is another leap by me, does JT Miller play center tonight? And now you're putting Zach McEwen in on the fourth line wing. Is that what happens? Does JT Miller go down the middle? That would make the most logical sense to me, but we'll see how this materializes. Travis Green, you will hear his press conference live during the course of this hour. I'm at Rogers Arena. We're going to have a Canuck come join us as well. I'm guessing it's not going to be Bo Horvat. I was one of the guys we were hoping to talk to, but I'm guessing that's not going to happen after the news that I've just shared with you here this morning. You want in on the conversation? Hit me up. You've got the Subway text line, 650-650. There are a couple of interesting storylines about tonight's game, one of them being the Benn brothers going head-to-head, something that can happen more often now that Jordy is playing on the West Coast with the Canucks, Jamie, of course, residing with Dallas, and we're talking about blue liners of a different variety. Miro Heiskanen comes in, was fantastic in his rookie season last year, really good. A lot of people felt he got robbed of not being a Calder finalist. Not many were going to say he had a better year than Elias Pettersson. I certainly wouldn't be among those. Your clear-cut Calder winner was Pettersson. But when we were having the discussion about whether or not Jordan Binnington should be eligible based on the amount of games he played, has he played enough? Should he really be in the running? The guy who got left out was Heiskanen. He was great for them last year, and he looks great to start the season for them. He's going to be so good for them for so long, at least that's the way it would appear. So you've got Quinn Hughes on one back end tonight. You've got Miro Heiskanen on the other. Guess who rolls in here on Saturday? The kid leading rookies in scoring. Cale Makar tearing it up right now for Colorado. He's a point-a-game player. It's kind of Brothers Week here at Rogers Arena with the Hughes brothers, now the Ben brothers, but it's also this young D-man week. The only guy who's not rolling in is Rasmus Dahlin. Again, off to a nice start in his second season with the Buffalo Sabres, a Calder finalist a year ago. So let's have this conversation. And you can give us a phone call right now if you want to have it, or you can simply text me or tweet me at Scott Rintoul is the Twitter handle. Which young defenseman would you want to build your blue line around moving forward? I understand you like your guy. And maybe that's your answer unequivocally because you get attached to your guy. And there's no wrong answer to me. It's just why you prefer which guy you prefer. So here's the five names I'm going to give you. Quinn Hughes, obviously. Cale Makar. Rasmus Dahlin. Miro Heiskanen. Or Charlie McAvoy, who's a little older than the guys I just mentioned, but he's still very young. So which of those five guys would you want to build your blue line around? As I said, there's no wrong answer here. They're all so good, so fast. And they look like they're going to be stalwarts for their teams for years to come. Is there one guy to you that separates himself from the list? Do you see more high-end offensive potential with Rasmus Dahlin and the ability to defend wrapped in with that, so you're going with him? Do you see that more all-around defenseman in Heiskanen who also might have the physical upside that a couple other guys on this list don't necessarily get you with? Who would you like to build your blue line around? Quinn Hughes, Cale Makar, Miro Heiskanen, Rasmus Dahlin, or Charlie McAvoy? One of those five, who are you taking? And if you think there's somebody who's in that very young category, relatively young category on the back end that I'm leaving out that needs to be on there, you can send that submission in as well. 650-650, that is the Subway text message inbox. As mentioned, Canucks tonight, Stars tonight. We'll talk about plenty of that. We'll have a Canuck here tableside in just a minute. Brian Burke was on our morning show today, and we were having the discussion earlier in the program about coaching and who's a great head coach, who's a good head coach. I don't know that you're pointing the fingers around the league right now and saying, oh, that guy can't coach. They better get rid of him. That generally doesn't happen in the NHL. We don't see a lot of that in the league these days. Brian Burke had an interesting take from a general manager's point of view about what's going on in Toronto right now. Lost again yesterday. Sky isn't falling in TO. They're 9-7-4. They've got 22 points. They've been without Tavares for a stretch. Now they're without Marner for a stretch. Still trying to figure out their goaltending situation. But the sky's not falling. That said, it's the center of the universe. There's always consternation about something. And one of the guys that has been the focal point is the head coach, Mike Babcock. Berkey was asked about that, how much pressure there is in Toronto, whether there's a disagreement between the GM, the head coach, whose style is going to take over. And he had this to say about Mike Babcock and how you evaluate a coach and when you need to make a change. Here's what he had to say.
I don't feel you have a right to fire the coach until you've given him a roster that's good enough to win. Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, Kyle would certainly feel he's given him enough talent that they should win some games. The counterargument to that would be, yes, but it's a flawed roster. There's holes in this roster. It's talent-rich, but it's not big enough or brave enough, and there's holes.
Yeah, there's holes, and it might not be big enough or brave enough. And this is why it's a fascinating discussion in Toronto, and I'm going to relate this back to Vancouver in just one second. The general manager, as we just talked to John Mattis about, he's going a little unconventional based on the time-honored tradition of how you construct your roster and how you construct a playoff roster that can win and how many heavy guys do you need and how much grit do you need. Well, heavy investment in skill over will in Toronto. More skill, more skill, more skill. That's what they've invested in Toronto. And everybody wonders if it jives with what Mike Babcock wants. Here's how this relates back to Vancouver. I agree with Brian Burke's assessment. There are extenuating circumstances in some case where a coach just has a major personality conflict with a young star and you have to choose between a coach and a star. But in most cases, until you give a coach a decent enough roster to win with, you can't just boot a guy. You can't say, well, we're not winning enough. Yeah, my roster sucks. What am I supposed to do? Travis Green, for the last 2 years, to me, has been an example of this. Travis Green, to me, has gotten the most he could out of the last 2 years' rosters. And you looked at those rosters and you knew they weren't good enough to get into the playoffs. But he extracted as much as he could out of them. So this year he's got a roster that is either capable of getting in or getting very close. So we get to evaluate Travis Green in a different manner. And I don't think this is a pass or fail year for Travis Green in the eyes of Jim Benning. I think he knows he has a good coach and it's a coach he wants to move forward with for quite some time. But we're going to evaluate Travis Green in a much different manner. But what did Jim Benning and Travis Green agree on? The types of guys, or in some cases, the specific players that Travis Green needed this year. And I think that's a healthy relationship, in my opinion. I think that's a very healthy relationship, in my opinion, that the head coach has input into what type of roster is being constructed. More on that. We'll continue this conversation, but I'm going to have one right now with JT Miller, who joins me here at Tableside at Rogers Arena. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm doing very well. How's the vibe around the team after snapping the slump the other night?
Yeah, it was a big win. I think we knew that we were doing a lot of good things. You know, like Coach said it perfectly, there's not a whole lot, you know, you can tell the difference between our wins and losses. I think it's a compliment for our team. We're doing a lot of good things, and we finally got some pucks to go into the back of the net, which is nice.
Yeah, I certainly did. And a guy in particular like Tanner Pearson who needed to get one, he got a couple the other night. You've been in that situation before. What does it feel like when you actually get that first one to go in and the red light goes on?
It's amazing. You know, you go through that stuff all the time. You get one, you feel like you're going to score every shift, and then you go a while, and you feel like you can do everything but put it in. But, you know, Tanner's a great player, and, you know, he's proven he can score goals in this league, so I'm sure that you know, nobody's really worried about him flying in the back of the net.
For you in particular, when you were younger in your career, was it tougher to deal with than perhaps now when you can say, I've been through this, it'll eventually get there?
Yeah, no doubt. You know, there's a lot more panic when you're younger. I think it takes the experience to learn that, you know, you got to be patient. It's a long season. It's not a 40-game season. It's 80, and it's, you know, there's a lot of things that can happen, ups and downs, but I think I've found that it's just really important to keep it even keel, even if it is going well. You know, I think that's, you never want to get too high. I think you can let the game think that it's too easy sometimes when it's going well, whether you know it or not. And you just got to keep playing the same way no matter what.
Is that just experience, or did somebody in either New York or Tampa Bay or a combination of players really get that across to you?
Yeah, for sure. I play with a lot of great veterans. You know, I've been every year I've, you know, been on playoff teams in my career so far. A lot of great older guys and guys have just tried to tell me, like, you know, you're going to be fine no matter what. It's just depending on the point of the season. Sometimes it goes great. Guys are, you know, you're winning, but you may not be producing like how you want. But, you know, the team's winning. It's all that matters. And I think our locker room is buying into that right now. You know, we really enjoy winning. We take the losses to heart. I think it's because we're playing well in those games still. And we played a really good team last game that was going to test us with the puck and, you know, management-wise. And I thought we did a really good job.
Probably same deal tonight. Dallas Stars in town. JT Miller and the Canucks will line up against them at Rogers Arena tonight. You talk about the buy-in with this group, and I think everybody who's watched your team would agree. How does that manifest itself as a player? What do you need to see to convince you that the team is all pulling on the same on the rope in the same direction?
Well, I think we're a really accountable group. We have great leadership in our locker room. We expect a lot out of each other, and I think when a big thing that comes up is puck management and being stubborn with it, and I think there's a lot of skill in young guys in this team, so it's harder to do that sometimes because a lot of the times the guys can make the play, but I've learned that, you know, if you just keep going forward with the puck and keep the defense on their heels, we've spent a lot of time in the other team's end so far this year, whether we're scoring or not, and I think that really is paying a big part. I know that when we're back on our heels and as a player, you know, you spend 20 to 30 seconds in your own end, you really don't have it in the offensive zone. So I think we found a good buy-in to that. We're playing physical. We're winning a lot of face-offs. I think that our team is, you know, we're doing a lot of good things. We're taking a lot of pride in our special teams, and we're still learning. But, you know, I think when that's the buy-in level is, you know, we got a little taste of winning so far this season, and I think that we really like it, and I think that it's more fun when we're winning, and I think it's easy to want to buy into that mindset.
And obviously you don't want to lose any games. That said, is it good for your team to face the adversity it's faced here over the past week, week and a half, when you were in a little bit of a tailspin, if you want to call it that, losing a few?
Yeah, sure. I think it's good. Obviously, you want to nip it in the bud as quick as possible, but I think that when you're down in those games, you learn a lot, and it's really hard to come back a lot of nights, and we were coming back quite a bit. So when you're trailing in the games in the third period, whether you're on the road or not, even though it is a good spot to be in, it's really taxing. You know, it's hard to come back. Teams block shots so well now and don't give up from the middle. So it's all part of the learning curve. We've got to be ready to start the game, and anytime we can get the lead, I think it's going to, you know, really help our chances.
Fair to say also that this team has to learn how to play with that lead late in games because, you know, the stat came out today, 42 of 44 days this year, there's been a comeback win in the NHL. It's just not what it used to be. You can't just lock it down. So you're trying to strike this balance between being aggressive and being responsible defensively. How long does it take to learn that?
Yeah, it takes time because you try to find that balance. You know, we played a game in New York this year, and we sat back for 20 minutes, and we blocked like 20 shots in the third and gave up 20 more, and it was just we won the game. But we knew that it's hard to win like that. It's really exhausting playing 100-foot hockey. And, you know, they're playing 100 feet on the good side, and we're on the bad side. And a couple nights later, I can't remember the team. We had the same situation, and we played aggressive, but we stayed within our structure to do it. We weren't taking chances, but you know, we try to preach playing the right way all the time, and I think that shouldn't matter if you're up or down. You should just keep playing the right way, and that goes back to the buy-in you were talking about. And so far this season, I think that if we want to be the team that, you know, we picture ourselves being, I think that we're going to play with leads a lot, and we got to learn how to deal with those situations.
We talk a lot about chemistry. You started the year with Bo Horvat. You've been playing with Elias Pettersson. Tonight, I'm not sure. We'll see how it goes, but you were lined up out there with Adam Gaudette. You're almost like the fixer. They put you on different lines. How do you see your role in that capacity in this forward group?
It's been my role, I think, most of my career so far. I think I can add something to any line, 1 through 4. That's not going to change my game at all. I tried to say that when I went to play with Petey and Best, that just because they're, you know, pretty high-end skill guys doesn't mean I'm going to try to play like them, because I've learned from the past that I get away from my game easily when I do that. But I'm just going to bring the same game. I think playing north-south, playing with them, you know, try to help Gods out in the middle. I don't think he's played a ton of middle so far this season. And I try to help him with some face-offs and some down-low play. And we're, you know, I just think that lots of talk and communication is helpful. Same with Sven. I think he's a really dangerous player. And I think if we're playing in the other team's zone, we're going to create a lot of chances. So just being north-south, don't give them other team any easy offenses, you know, really is the recipe sometimes. And I think that there's enough skill throughout our lineup that it doesn't really matter who you're playing with. You're going to get some looks.
Those young, skilled guys on this team, you knew about them when you got dealt here, but you didn't know them, especially being in the Eastern Conference. What have you learned about the likes of Pettersson, Besser, Horvat, Hughes since being here?
I learned a lot. You know, I spent a lot of time with those four on the power play unit, so we do a lot of talking, and, you know, they see the game really well. I think we're still learning as a power play in particular, not to get on the power play, but that's where I spend most time with those guys. And obviously they're really special. I see a lot of highlight reel stuff being on the other side of the continent last year. And, you know, obviously learning a lot about Quinn this year. I didn't get to see him play at all last year when he got called up. He's a really special player. You know, he's learning a lot. He's learning a lot on the power play, how to be a quarterback. And, you know, it's a special group. And that's something that I think that the team really took pride in this year when we saw the guys that that Jim brought in. And, you know, it's really exciting because we knew we were adding to this really special young team, and with a good mix of old and new. So it's exciting. You know, I'm really looking forward to the future here.
Yeah, it's a good word for it. It's been exciting in the building, too. The vibe, the energy's back in this rink, and that'll continue tonight. Thank you very much for doing this. Best of luck against the Stars.
No problem. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, JT.
Yep.
That's JT Miller joining me here. A lot of really interesting things to talk about with him and his role, and he's very comfortable. It doesn't matter what line he's in. And, hey, I think that's something he spoke out with Friedman, and he just intimated to me right now that maybe early in his career he would have tried to play differently depending on what line he was on. And now, hey, I just got to be me. And that's going to rub off in a positive manner on those around me because I can be effective no matter what role they put me in on this team. We'll see if he lines up with Adam Gaudette and Sven Berchi tonight. I like the looks of that. I like the fact they're giving Adam Gaudette offensive players around him heading into this game tonight. We'll see what Travis Green has to say. He'll be at the podium next. We're live at Rogers Arena. It's a Canucks game day on your home of Canucks hockey, Sportsnet 650.
Yeah. Now more of the Scott Rintoul Show.
Canucks game day, Rogers Arena, Dallas Stars, the third team in this four-game homestand. It'll be Colorado on Saturday. One of the questions we throw out as we await Travis Green at the podium, we'll see if we get an update on Bo Horvat. Left the morning skate a little early. I don't think there's a lot of concern right now, but we'll see what the head coach has to say. He left skate a little early. Right now, slated to have Jake Virtanen and Tanner Pearson on his wings tonight. Levo remains on the top line with Pettersson and Besser. And the newly formed line of Adam Gaudette in the middle, JT Miller on one side, Sven Berchi on the other. That's a line that should be able to give you some offensive opportunity here tonight. And very good point by JT Miller in the conversation we just had. Also putting him on that line eases the pressure of Adam Gaudette in the faceoff circle. And he brings another responsible defensive presence to that line. I called him the fixer, and that's kind of what he's been. Started on the Bo Horvat line. Everybody thought that was a good idea, liked the combination of those two together. And then when Pettersson and Besser were off to, by their standards, relatively slow starts, JT Miller moved up there. Michael Ferland just didn't seem like a fit at the time. So there goes Miller, and relatively instant chemistry with Pettersson and Besser. And that is your default. That is your default with this team from what I've seen. If something goes wrong with anything and they need goals, Miller with Pettersson and Besser, we know that works, and that should be able to work at any time. Levo had some nice opportunities there the other night. Wasn't able to close on them, but was getting to the right spots. Miller with Gaudette and Berchi, I like for this reason. If Brandon Sutter isn't your third line center, if that's what we're going to call the third line, well, now you got a center who's an offensive guy. Give him some offensive players to play with. And I like that adaptation. I like saying we're more reliable defensively with Pearson and Horvat playing together. Even though Berchi and Horvat have had some chemistry in the past, hey, Berchi, Gaudette, Miller. Okay, that line can go out there and get you something. And I like the adjustment by Travis Green. This is all assuming Bo Horvat is healthy and ready to go tonight. We'll get an update from the head coach on that here momentarily. We're also going to see Miro Heiskanen take on Quinn Hughes tonight. One of the games within the game, if you will. And I threw this out there. Young defenseman, who you want to build your blue line around? Rasmus Dahlin, Quinn Hughes, Cale Makar, Miro Heiskanen. Charlie McAvoy is a name I throw out. Bean and Delta says Thomas Chabot. You've got to have that name on the list. Absolutely. Fair point. Put Thomas Chabot on that list as well. McAvoy and Chabot a little bit older than the group I mentioned. But there's no wrong answer. Someone texts in, there isn't a bad choice, but man, Rasmus Dahlin, he is fantastic. That might be the guy you want to go with. Jordan from Abbotsford, he's on his guy. He says, nope, it's the guy here. Jordan says, Quinn Hughes, for these reasons, very little history of injuries, fantastic leadership qualities. In Jordan's opinion, he's captain material. Leads by example, much like Horvat. One of the top five fastest skaters in the league. Elite vision, makes every play. Every player better who plays with him. He's elusive, extremely competitive, mature for his age. Father's coaching through his early career, family lineage of high-end athletes. Extremely competitive nature. Already one of the top 15 offensive D-men in the league as a 19-year-old, which is extremely rare. So much potential. That's Jordan from Abbotsford who says, yeah, we're in to win with Quinn. He would go with Quinn Hughes. I think a lot of what you said there, outside of maybe some lineage and father coaching at certain ages comments, I think a lot of that applies to Cale Makar. That'll be fun on Saturday too. Cale Makar rolling in here. But tonight it's Heiskanen, it's Hughes, it's the Dallas Stars, it's the Vancouver Canucks. Similar records, I suppose. 20 points for the Stars through 19 games. 23 points for the Vancouver Canucks through 19 games. Stars coming off that 3-1 win in Calgary last night. And despite the coach calling out two big-name guys, Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin on the weekend, this team is 8-1-1 in its last 10 games. Even though they're not getting what they need from those two guys in particular, and they're doing this with a couple of injuries right now. Klingberg out. Roope Hintz has been out. Those are a couple of significant pieces. And when you're missing those guys, one who provides offense from the back end and another guy who has just been a bit of a revelation in last year's playoffs in hints and has carried that right over here into the season. 11 points through his first 16 games, including 9 goals. You miss those two guys, plus you're not getting offensive contributions that you need from Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin. I can understand why that gets frustrating as a head coach. Bottom line is, if those two guys aren't going, and I'm missing a couple of players like I just mentioned, I can live with it when I'm 8-1-1 in my last 10. That's when I can live with it. It's when we're not winning games that I have a bit of a problem with it. So it's a good problem to have for Jim Montgomery, at least in my estimation. We're going to get to Travis Green in just a couple of minutes here. As mentioned, the Dallas Stars were in Calgary last night. One of my favorite moments of what I saw in sports yesterday was Justin Dowling, who's a Calgary native. He'll be here tonight with the Stars. He gets his first NHL goal. He's a journeyman as far as his pro career has gone. Didn't get drafted. Had to work his way up from the ECHL to the AHL. Has played over 400 games in the A. Just 34 games in the show. Double-digit games last season, but not that many. 14 games here this year prior to last night. And what does he do? He goes out and gets his first goal ever in his hometown. And his parents are there, and his family's there, and everybody's having a good time. In fact, everybody's having a good time, and mom misses the goal. We've got the audio of Raja. We've got to play this. This is one of my favorite moments of last night.
Welcome back to the Saddle, and welcome in Sherry Dowling, mom to Justin Dowling, here to witness his first ever NHL goal from Cochrane. Great to have the friends and family here, Sherry. Feel bad you missed the goal. Why?
I was dealing with a drink.
Priority.
I was dealing with a drink. I love it. I love it. We can all relate to that. Guaranteed you've missed something when you're in a beer line somewhere, or just be a minute. I just got to run out and use the facilities. I'll be right back, and you don't get back to your seat in time, and you miss something big. Probably not your son's first goal, but I love the fact she was honest about it. He had a good laugh about it after the game. He was doing the post game with Ryan Leslie on the Calgary broadcast last night, and Leslie said, I hate to break this to you, but your mom missed the goal. Oh, she did? Oh, yeah. Okay, how come? Well, she was getting a drink. He said, that sounds like the Dowlings. Yeah, we have good time at games. And he kind of laughed it off and said, I'm glad she's having a great time at the game tonight. But that, to me, was a great moment, a very relatable moment for everybody who's been to a hockey game, who's missed something at one point in time, different sporting event. You've been there. I was going to save this to the end of the hour, but I'm not sure when Travis Green is coming up on the podium. He'll be there momentarily, I would suspect. Here he is, in fact. All right, let's go.
Van Beagle?
Not in tonight.
Just calling day to day at this point?
Yeah.
Marky?
Yeah. Just chilling in the back, eh?
Does Tyler Graevac get in tonight?
Yeah.
What do you remember from camp in the preseason?
I liked him. Thought he had a good camp. Smart, fairly heavy stick. He's been a pro for a while now. I think he understands certain parts of the game. And as far as filling in for a fourth line spot, that made the most sense.
You had said during training camp that he was a player that you remembered playing or coaching against. What stood out about his game that drew you to him even now?
Just I thought he was good at good in the American League. I thought he was a guy that had a bright future. I can't remember if we were in Iowa when we played against him, when I asked our assistant coaches about him. I just thought that he was one of those guys that thought would be an NHLer.
And what about Zach McEwen? I mean, again, you know, he's a player we saw a bit last year. What did you, you know, want? What did you see from him in training camp and what, you know, hoping to see from him in his latest stint here?
Well, we know Zach well. He's been a product of our organization and he's put a lot of hard work in. I think, we called him up as an option, probably in our bottom. We know what he is. If he's going to play, he's going to be in the bottom six. And, we'll see where that goes.
Travis, your club had a big game on the power play against Nashville on Tuesday, but we know you tend to evaluate your club's performance based more on process. And what have you seen out of your power play over the last week to 10 days, just in terms of generating shots and volume?
It's been okay. I think teams are dialing in on those young guys. which is something they're going to have. They're not going to get any easy nights, and that's something that they'll learn as they go as well. And they've got to be dialed in. I think we've had a couple power plays where we weren't, I don't want to say ready, but sharp and ready for pressure and caught them by surprise a little bit. And much like they've maybe caught some teams by surprise some nights, it goes both ways. I like the other night that we got two goals from our second unit. I think that's huge. And, there's going to be nights where I think our young power play is going to look really good, and there's going to be some nights where maybe they struggle a bit.
When you bump up Hughes to the top unit and they have a really loud performance, like they did against LA there,
right?
Can you notice it immediately, just a change in terms of how they're being game planned for on the other end?
I think after that game there was definitely some harder adjustments being made, and now it's taken them some time to probably adjust to that. And I tried to explain this before, where there's little adjustments that power plays make even in game, and that takes a little bit of time to learn in the league as well. And I think we're going to see some really good things out of that group, and there might be some nights where they struggle as well, but that happens with a lot of power plays in the league, not just ours because they're young, but it might happen because they are young once in a while.
One thing that I just had been meaning to ask you was, with the neutral zone breakout on the top unit, you tend to have Petey at the sort of right wing. I know you won't get into too many details, but is there sort of a conscious effort to have him set up in zone relatively quickly to get a pass or sort of be a shooting option early?
I mean, there's
on
different reasons that we have put guys in different spots. And, you know, part of it is, actually, I'm not going to get into it exactly, but there are, I will tell you, there are different reasons why we put guys in spots, like you said, and not necessarily just for looking for a shot right away when you get into the zone.
Besides your missed durability, I think Jordy Ben only missed six games the last 2 years at the Habs, and he's played them all. What do you like most about him? The fact that we don't notice him in the third pairing, and he's come as advertised?
I think our team notices him.
Yeah,
I think he does a lot of things that are noticeable if you're really watching the game.
But I mean, mistake-wise, like usually if there's a big mistake, you'll notice, you'll see a number, but...
Well, I think he's come as advertised. Yeah. He's solid. He does a lot of good things that sometimes go unnoticed, and a lot of things that add up at the end of the night to wins. Yeah, I think he's been a solid addition to our group and has helped solidify our defensive play a little bit.
What's Thatcher showing you in these additional games that he's got, given Marky's circumstances?
I don't think he hasn't. It's not because of Marky's circumstance. We plan on playing Thatcher. I'm not saying he's going to play every night, but we want him to play some games. I don't think anything's really surprising us. He's a good goalie. There's a reason why we were committed to going with him. It's a reason why we've taken the time to make sure he was ready. And, he's played well.
Is he making a case for more games, or do you just view this as a situation where maybe Marky's better off at the end for not having a shoulder?
Yeah, he's just we got both goalies playing well, and that's what you want in both your goalies. So,
will Roussel travel next week?
Not sure.
Charles, what's your sense of your opponent tonight and how they're getting it done? I mean, they got off to a slow start, obviously. It looks like they figured something out, and they're just not giving up much. I mean, are there some games more than others? I know you tell us there are no easy games in this league, but are there some games where you know you're going to have to grind more than others?
I think, the one thing about Dallas is they don't give up a lot. They did that last year as well. You know, when you play this team, you got to work for everything you get. They had a great season last year. They were close to going a lot farther. And, I think there are some teams that you just know it's going to be a working night. You got to work for what you got, and tonight's one of those nights.
You talk about being open and honest with your players. Some coaches in the league will actually name players. I mean, you're very good at talking about a specific problem that you may be having collectively, but is that just your DNA in terms of the way you assess players? You won't go before the podium and say we need more from a certain player. Is that just...
I know where you're going with this. Yeah. I don't need to comment on what anyone else is doing. You guys know how I talk in the media, and whatever anyone else does is their business, and everyone's a good coach in this league. I know.
Well, not going after a coach, I'm just saying in terms of your players, the relationship that you have with your players, they know that your door's open. If there's something you guys need to talk about, we'll talk about it.
I think they know. I'm pretty straightforward with them when they're playing well, and I tell them that. When they're not playing well, I also talk to them. And not necessarily, it's not always in a negative way either. Sometimes you talk a guy through a tough situation. Sometimes you're harder on guys and more blunt. I think... that's the way I like to approach things. As a player, you want to be treated that way, and I think a lot of coaches are like that.
Has Ferland made any progress since we
left? No, he's still in the protocol. So,
Travis, with the injuries you've dealt with, obviously it looks from the outside like this is a pretty significant opportunity for Adam Gaudette. Mm-hmm. In terms of how you approach sort of widening your group as much as possible, considering the forward injuries you're dealing with, how are you approaching it?
Say that again. You lost me there.
Specifically
Adam Gaudette or the whole group?
The whole group, but specifically with Adam Gaudette, you've obviously played him with some veteran guys like Sutter as the season's gone along.
Yeah.
Is there similar thinking there with a guy like Miller?
A little bit. No, I thought God said, man, he was good last game. Really good. And, now this is an opportunity to show that he can bring it consistently and have consistency in his game. And, you'll probably see some juggling tonight a little bit based on matchups and me trying to protect. I got two young centermen with Gods and Petey, and I'll use Petey's line now. I have been against other top lines, and I use Bo's line. But I liked the look of him and Miller a little bit last game. I thought he gave us some good looks. And... hopefully he has another good game tonight. Okay.
Alarm going off. Press conference must end. That was the timer that was on. You know that tone if you've got yourself an iPhone. You know that tone. That's when the timer goes off. Okay, we're out of here. I'm not sure if there was a mandated time or if somebody else's alarm went. I have no idea. Okay, a few things coming out of Travis Green's press conference here momentarily. I want to get this news to you first because it's significant and it's a little frightening. We wondered, okay, what's wrong with Bo Horvat when he comes off the ice? That he's fine, by the way. He's in the lineup tonight. That seems so minor compared to this. TJ Brody at Flames practice this morning, he had some kind of seizure on the ice. He collapsed on the ice during practice, had what appeared to be a seizure, according to reporters who were on hand. Practice stopped immediately. Ambulance got him on the way to the hospital. Apparently he looked alert leaving the Saddle Dome, but there's not a confirmed report of that, but he's on his way to the hospital. You want to talk about a scary incident? They had one in Calgary today with TJ Brody. We'll get you more information on that as it becomes available, but man, you want to talk about shaking teammates and just getting a little bit rattled by seeing something. Hopefully TJ Brody is okay, but that's the news coming out of Calgary. That just broke toward the tail end of Travis Green's press conference. As for what's going on with the Vancouver Canucks, Bo Horvat, good to go in the lineup tonight. So it will be Horvat between Vertanen and Pearson, Gaudette centers Miller and Berchi. You heard Travis Green at the end of that press conference say, yeah, there's going to be a little juggling tonight. I got a couple of young centermen in Elias Pettersson and Adam Gaudette. He also admitted, I'm not afraid to play my top line against other top lines. So I'm not afraid with that responsibility for Pettersson. But we know from a face-off standpoint that the coach would like to protect his young centerman. Elias Pettersson hasn't taken a ton of face-offs this year. That's a responsibility that often fell to JT Miller on that line. Adam Gaudette, we'll see how he does in the circle tonight. But now he's got JT Miller at his disposal. Bo Horvat, a guy who's leaned on a lot in that capacity, and he will center Vertanen and Pearson, as mentioned. A couple of other significant items coming out of there. Jacob Markstrom goes back into the goal tonight. Demko was very good the other night, but now Markstrom gets his opportunity against the Dallas Stars. Brandon Sutter, he'll be evaluated in a week. It is a groin strain. So this isn't a one-off for Adam Gaudette. We'll see how he looks tonight between Miller and Berchi, if that line stays intact for the bulk of the game. But this is going to be an extended run here. Travis Green talked about it. Really likes the way he's played. This is a guy who has not gone back-to-back games without a point. It's been under the radar because Adam Gaudette hasn't been in the lineup all the time. He was in Utica for a very short stint before getting called up, and he hasn't been a regular, but he hasn't gone two games in a row without registering a point. Significant for a team that, yeah, does need some offense to come from, quote-unquote, the other guys. Guys off that Pedersen, Besser, and whoever line tonight, it'll be Levo. We'll see if he can get something going there as well. But this line with Berchi, Gaudette, and Miller, that's going to be relied upon to produce. That has the offensive potential. Berchi got a point the other night, looked like a guy to me that was on the verge of a breakthrough when it came to goal scoring. He's in the right spots, should have finished the one opportunity. Pekka Rinne made a nice save, but Berchi's putting himself in the high danger spots. There's zero trepidation. Let's see if he gets going tonight with Gaudette coming off that 1-1 performance. JT Miller has been Mr. Consistent for this hockey team. I like the look of that line. Even though, as I said, if I were drawing this up today, I probably still would have had JT Miller playing with Pedersen and Besser, but the other reasons make a lot of sense. And trying to protect Adam Gaudette to a certain degree, whether it's with face-offs or defensive responsibility, makes a lot of sense. The bigger picture to me is that they didn't say, let's try to load up the Bo Horvat line, let's give him the best opportunity with offensive skilled wingers. No, Bo Horvat's going to have to shoulder more defensive responsibility now. Now that Brandon Sutter's not in the lineup. Now that Jay Beagle's not playing tonight as well. So we get to see Tyler Greyovac. Certainly brings some size to that fourth line. 6'5", 210. So you're going to see a bigger body out there. And a guy who's played in the show before. He's got 62 games under his belt. But with no Beagle, no Sutter, roles change a little bit here. And that's part of what Bo Horvat, what makes him so attractive as a player for this team, it's part of what's made him a captain of this team, is that he's shown the ability to take on different roles, and we'll see how he is utilized tonight. It's not as though his wingers can't score, but he hasn't been given the two most skilled wingers possible in this lineup. That's gone to Adam Gaudette after the Pedersen line. Pedersen still gets Besser, but Berchi and Miller with Gaudette, that's significant. I also found it interesting when asked about Antoine Roussel, and whether or not he would travel on this upcoming trip, Travis Green said, not sure. He was out there practicing today. He's wearing the non-contact jersey. That, to me, says he's going. We'll wait and see. See how he feels from today to tomorrow. This team has a 6-game road trip coming up. Game 4 of this 4-game homestand goes Saturday against Colorado, and then the rest of the month they are away. If I had to bet today, I would bet Antoine Roussel's on this trip, especially given some of the injuries they have right now. And we'll see what happens with Brandon Sutter and Michael Ferland, as you heard, the update with him, still in the protocol. That means it's going to be a while. You just never know. It's the nebulous nature of concussions. Have no idea. Dallas Stars coming off a win. Vancouver Canucks coming off a win. They go head-to-head tonight. Another opportunity for Vancouver to take advantage of a tired team. People talked about this when the Canucks were playing 4 of 6 and they're on the road playing back-to-backs. Well, did Winnipeg get to take advantage of a tired team? Yeah, that's fine. But Vancouver has the same opportunity, and they get it tonight. Very good at home, 5-1-2 on home ice. We're going to kick around a lot of these topics coming up in the next hour. Israel Fair set to join us here at Rogers Arena. Bick Nizar is going to step in. He's made his way down here. I think he was in the Travis Green press conference. I don't know how much interrogation Bick applied to him. Certainly not as much as the coups in there, based on what I heard during the press conference. But we'll get his impressions as well. That's coming up next on your home of the Vancouver Canucks. Your home of hockey, Sportsnet 650.